Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
No, but see, in other words, if you know what your game is, you know what your agenda has to be. You are not walking around, well, we got to get an agenda. That's us. Well, we got to meet and see if we can work out our agenda. No, people who know what their mission is, this is their mission. White genetic survival. In all of these areas of activity, bringing into play by any means necessary. That's what Stoddard gently talks about. I had looked at this book a long time ago, but something brought it to my attention. And I say, this has got to be required reading. Now, somebody said, you can download it on the internet. So I don't know. But this costs $20. See, they know what their issue is on the planet. What is our issue and our mission? Our mission is, can't we all just get along? Now, that sounds okay in heaven. See, but in other words, to function and not be crazy, you've got to deal with reality. You've got to be able to assess reality. A critical mental health question, examine the patient. Are they oriented? Do they know who they are? Do they know where they are? And do they know what time it is? See, now that means, do we know that we are black people in a system of racism, white supremacy, and that we are the victims of that system? I ain't no victim. Ain't nobody telling me what to do. I mean, if somebody can decide whether you're going to be employed, they have determined your entire life.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully, to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 25th, 2016. So I have been told this is Black Friday. So they tell me, I guess, tomorrow will be Negro Saturday. This is our fifth book study session on Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. We are picking up on chapter 9. We are getting through the book much faster than I anticipated. Thanks again to our sound editor, Mel, and our narrator, Universal Alien. They have done a phenomenal job getting the material together. It has been great, and appreciating their work contribution to our book study sessions. But that was Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, audio segment at the beginning of the program. That was from her final lecture at the Kress-Welsing Institute I played previously, where she talked about the prediction that Donald Trump would win the election. Same lecture. She talked about the importance of reading that book. And then again, about an hour later into the lecture, it's about a three-hour lecture, about an hour later, she comes back to that book to make a point again about the system of racism, white supremacy, their agenda to continue domination of non-white people in order to stave off white genetic annihilation, and then non-white people us being confused about what it means to be white, what racism, white supremacy is, and how it works. I think the reason she wanted us to read this book is to gain some insight on both of those points. We will continue. Once again, I want to remind listeners, if you read the debate between Stoddard and W.E.B. Du Bois, their 1929 debate, I have posted it on Facebook. It's linked in the description. I've emailed it to people who requested. If you read it, we are going to include commentary on that as we go. So if you see links or just anything in that debate is important that you want to share, feel free. Without further ado, we will get started. Again, we're picking up in Chapter 9, beginning of Chapter 9, The Shattering of White Solidarity. This is Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 1.
Chapter 9, The Shattering of White Solidarity. The instinctive comedy of the white people is, as I have already said, perhaps the greatest constant of history. It is the psychological basis of white civilization. Cohesive instinct is as vital to race as gravitation is to matter. Without them, atomic disintegration would alike result. In speaking of race instinct, I am not referring merely to the ethnic theories that have been elaborated at various times. Those theories were, after all, but attempts to explain intellectually the urge of that profound emotion known to sociologists as the consciousness of kind. White race consciousness has been, of course, perturbed by numberless internal frictions, which have at times produced partial inhibitions of unitary feeling. Nevertheless, when really faced by non-white opposition, white men have in the past instinctively tended to close their ranks against the common foe. One of the Great War's most deplorable results has been an unprecedented weakening of white solidarity, which, if not repaired, may produce the most disastrous consequences. During the 19th century, the sentiment of white solidarity was strong. The great explorers and empire builders who spread white ascendancy to the ends of the earth were apostles of their race and civilization as well as of a particular country. Rivalries might be keen and colonial boundary questions acute. Nevertheless, in their calmer moments, the white peoples felt that the expansion of one white nation buttressed the expansion of all. Professor Pearson undoubtedly voiced the spirit of the day when he wrote, about 1890, that it would be well, quote, if European statesmen could understand that the wars which carry desolation into civilized countries are allowing the lower races to recruit their numbers and strength. 2 centuries hence, it may be matter of serious concern to the world if Russia has been displaced by China on the Amur, if France has not been able to colonize North Africa, or if England is not holding India. For civilized men, there can be only one fatherland, and whatever extends the influence of those races that have taken their faith from Palestine, their laws of beauty from Greece, and their civil law from Rome, ought to be matter of rejoicing to Russian, German, Anglo-Saxon, and Frenchmen alike. End quote. The progress of science also fortified white race consciousness with its sanctions. The researches of European scholars identified the founders of our civilization with a race of tall, white-skinned barbarians, possessing regular features, brown or blonde hair, and light eyes. This was, of course, what we now know as the Nordic type. At first, the problem was ill understood, the tests applied being language and culture, rather than physical characteristics. For these reasons, the early Caucasian and Aryan hypothesis were self-contradictory and inadequate. Nevertheless, the basis was sound, and the effects on white popular psychology were excellent. Particularly good were the effects upon the peoples predominantly of Nordic blood. Obviously typifying as they did the prehistoric creators of white civilization, Nordics everywhere were strengthened in consciousness of genetic worth, feeling of responsibility for world progress, and urge toward fraternal collaboration. The supreme value of Nordic blood was clearly analyzed by the French thinker Count Arthur de Gobineau as early as 1854, albeit Gobineau employed the misleading Aryan terminology, and his thesis was subsequently elaborated by many other writers, notably by Englishmen, Germans, and Scandinavians. The results of all this were plainly apparent by the closing years of the 19th century. Quickened Nordic race consciousness played an important part in stimulating Anglo-American fraternization and induced acts like the Oxford scholarship legacy of Cecil Rhodes. The trend of this movement, though cross-cut by nationalistic considerations, was clearly in the direction of a Nordic Entente, a pan-Nordic syndication of power for the safeguarding of the race heritage of the harmonious evolution of the whole white world. It was a glorious aspiration, which, had it been realized, would have averted Armageddon. Unfortunately, the aspiration remained a dream. The ill-balanced tendencies of the late 19th century were against it, and they ultimately prevailed. The abnormal growth of national imperialism, in particular, wrought fatal havoc. The exponents of imperialistic propagandas like Pan-Germanism and Pan-Slavism put forth literally boundless pretensions, planning the domination of the entire planet by their special brand of national imperialism. Such men had scant regard for race lines. All who stood outside their particular nationalistic group were vowed to the same subjection. Indeed, the national imperialists presently seized upon race teachings and prostituted them to their own ends. A notable example of this is the extreme pan-German propaganda of Houston Stuart Chamberlain and his fellows. Chamberlain makes two cardinal assumptions. He conceives modern Germany as racially almost purely Nordic, and he regards all Nordics outside the German linguistic cultural group as either unconscious or renegade Teutons, who must at all costs be brought into the German fold. To anyone who understands the scientific realities of race, the monstrous absurdity of these assumptions is instantly apparent. The fact is that modern Germany, far from being purely Nordic, is mainly Alpine in race. Nordic blood preponderates only in the Northwest, and is merely veneered over the rest of Germany, especially in the upper classes. While the Germania of Roman days was unquestionably a Nordic land, it has been computed that of the 70 million inhabitants of the German Empire in 1914, only 9 million were purely Nordic in character. This displacement of the German Nordics since classic times is chiefly due to Germany's troubled history, especially to the horrible 30 Years' War, which virtually annihilated the Nordics of South Germany. This racial displacement has wrought correspondingly profound changes in the character of the German people. The truth of the matter is, of course, that the Pan-Germans were thinking in terms of nationality instead of race, and that they were using pseudo-racial arguments as camouflage for essentially political ends. The pity of it is that these arguments have had such disastrous repercussions in the genuine racial sphere. The late war has not only exploded Pan-Germanism, it has also discredited Nordic race feeling, so unjustly confused by many persons with Pan-German nationalistic propaganda. Such persons should remember that the overwhelming majority of Nordics live outside of Germany, being mainly found in Scandinavia, the Anglo-Saxon countries, Northern France, the Netherlands, and Baltic Russia. To let Teuton propaganda gull us into thinking of Germany as the Nordic fatherland is both a danger and an absurdity. While Pan-Germanism was mainly responsible for precipitating Armageddon with all its disastrous consequences, it was Russian Pan-Slavism which dealt the first shrewd blow to white solidarity. toward the close of the 19th century, Pan-Slavism's Eastern Wing, led by Prince Okhtomsky and other chauvinists of his ilk, went so far in its imperialistic obsession as actually to deny Russia's white blood. These Pan-Slavists boldly proclaimed the morbid, mystical dogma that Russia was Asiatic, not European, and thereupon attempted to seize China as a lever for upsetting first the rest of Asia and then the non-Russian white world, elegantly described as the Rotten West. The white power immediately menaced was, of course, England, who in acute fear for her Indian Empire promptly riposted by allying herself with Japan. Russia was diplomatically isolated and militarily beaten in the Russo-Japanese War. Thus, the Russo-Japanese War, that destroyer of white prestige whose ominous results we have already noted, was precipitated mainly by the reckless short-sightedness of white men themselves. A second blow to white solidarity was presently administered, this time by England, in concluding her second alliance treaty with Japan. The original alliance, signed in 1902, was negotiated for a definite, limited objective: the checkmating of Russia's overweening imperialism. Even that instrument was dangerous, but under the circumstances, it was justifiable and inevitable. The second alliance treaty, however, was so general and far-reaching in character that practically all white men in the Far East, including most emphatically Englishmen themselves, pronounced it a great disaster. Meanwhile, German imperialism was plotting even deadlier strokes at white race comity, not merely by preparing war against white neighbors in Europe, but also by ingratiating itself with the Muslim East and by toying with schemes for building up a black military empire in Central Africa. Lastly, France was actually recruiting black, brown, and yellow hordes for use on European battlefields, while Italy, by her buccaneering raid on Tripoli, outraged Islam's sense of justice and strained its patience to the breaking point. Thus, in the years preceding Armageddon, all the European powers displayed a reckless absorption in particularistic ambitions and showed a callous indifference to larger race interests. The rapid weakening of white solidarity was clearly apparent. However, white solidarity, though diplomatically compromised, was emotionally not yet really undermined. Those dangerous games above mentioned were largely the work of cynical chancelleries and ultra-imperialist propagandas. The average European, whatever his nationality, still tended to react instinctively against such practices. This was shown by the sharp criticism which arose from the most varied quarters. For example, Russia and Britain were alike sternly taken to task, both at home and abroad, for their respective Far Eastern policies. Proposed German alliances with Pan-Islamism and Japan, preached by disciples of Machtpolitik, were strenuously opposed as race treason by powerful sections of German thought. While Italy's Tripolitan imbroglio was generally denounced as the most foolhardy trifling with the common European interest. A good illustration of instinctive white solidarity in the early years of the 20th century is a French journalist's description of the attitude of the white spectators of various nationalities gathered to watch the landing in Japan of the first Russian prisoners taken in the Russo-Japanese War. This writer depicts in moving language the literally horrifying effect of the spectacle upon himself and his fellows. Quote, "What a triumph," end quote, he exclaims. Quote, "What a revenge for the little Nippons to see thus humiliated these big, splendid men who, for them, represented not only Russians, but those Europeans whom they so detest. This scene, tragic in its simplicity, this grief passing amid joy, these whites, vanquished and captives, defiling before those free and triumphant yellows, this was not Russia beaten by Japan, not the defeat of one nation by another. It was something new, enormous, prodigious. It was the victory of one world over another. It was the revenge which effaced the centuries of humiliations borne by Asia. It was the awakening hope of the Oriental peoples. It was the first blow given to the other race, to that accursed race of the West, which, for so many years, had triumphed without even having to struggle. And the Japanese crowd felt all this, and the few other Asiatics who found themselves there shared in this triumph. The humiliation of these whites was solemn, frightful. I completely forgot that these captives were Russians, and I would add that the other Europeans there, though anti-Russian, felt the same malaise. They also were forced to feel that these captives were their own kind. When we took the train for Kobe, an instinctive solidarity drove us huddling into the same compartment. End quote. Thus, white solidarity, while unquestionably weakened, was still a weighty factor down to August 1914. But the first shots of Armageddon saw white solidarity literally blown from the muzzles of the guns. An explosion of internecine hatred burst forth more intense and general than any ever known before. Both sets of combatants proclaimed a duel to the death. Both sides vowed the enemy to something near annihilation. While even scientists and literateurs, disrupting the ancient commonwealths of wisdom and beauty, put one another furiously to the ban. In their savage death grapple, neither side hesitated for an instant to grasp at any weapon, whatever the ultimate consequences to the race. The Allies poured into white Europe, colored hordes of every pigment under the sun. The Teutonic powers wielded pan-Islam as a besom of wrath to sweep clean every white foothold in hither Asia and North Africa. While far and wide over the dark continent, black armies fought for their respective masters and learned the hidden weaknesses of the white man's power. In the Far East, Japan, left to her own devices, bent amorphous China to her imperious will, thereby raising up a potential menace for the entire earth. Every day the tide of intestine hatred within the white world rose higher, until the very concept of a common blood and cultural past seemed in danger of being blotted out. A symposium of the hate literature of the Great War is fortunately no part of my task, but the reader will readily recall both its abysmal fury and its irreconcilable implications. The most appalling feature was the way in which many writers assumed that this state of mind would be permanent, that the end of the Great War might be only the beginning of a war cycle leading to the utter disruption of white solidarity and civilization. In the spring of 1916, the London Nation remarked gloomily, quote, "Europe is now being mentally conceived as inevitably and permanently dual. We are ceasing to think of Europe. The normal end of war, which is peace, is to be submerged in the idea of a war series indefinitely prolonged. Soon, the entire continent will have but one longing, the longing for rest. The cup is to be dashed from its lips. For a world steeped in fear and ruled by the barren logomachy of hate, diplomatic intercourse would almost cease to be possible. In the matter of culture, modern Europe would tend to relapse to a state inferior even to that of medieval Europe, and to sink far below that of the Renaissance." End quote. In similar vein, the noted German historian Edward Meyer predicted that Armageddon was only the first of a long series of Anglo-German Punic Wars in which modern civilization would retrograde to a condition of semi-barbarism. Germany, according to this prophecy, would be the victor, but a Pyrrhic victor, for the colored races, taking advantage of white decadence, would destroy European supremacy and involve all the white nations in a common ruin. The ulcerated state of European war psychology did, in fact, lend ominous emphasis to these gloomy prognostications. Before 1914, as we have seen, imperialistic trafficking with common race interests usually roused widespread criticism, while even more, the use of colored troops in white quarrels always roused bitter popular condemnation. In the darkest hours of the Boer War, English public opinion had refused to sanction the use of either black African or brown Indian troops against the white foe, while French plans for raising black armies of African savages for use in Europe were almost universally reprobated. Before Armageddon, there thus existed a genuine moral repugnance against settling domestic differences by calling in the alien without the gates. The Great War, however, sent all such scruples promptly into the discard. Not only did the belligerent governments use all the colored troops they could equip, but the belligerent peoples hailed this action with unqualified approval. The Allies were, of course, the more successful in practice, but the Germans were just as eager, and the exertions of the Prussian general Lehmann von Sanders actually got Turkish divisions to the European battlefronts. The psychological effect of these colored auxiliaries in deepening the hatred of the white combatants was deplorable. Germany's use of Turks raised among the Allies wrathful emotions reminiscent of the Crusades, while the havoc wrought in the Teutonic ranks by black Senegalese and yellow Gurkhas, together with Allied utterances like Lord Curzon's wish to see Bengal lancers on the Unter den Linden, and Gurkhas camping at Sans Souci, so maddened the German people that the very suggestion of white solidarity was jeeringly scoffed at as the most idiotic sentimentality. Here is a German officer's account of a Senegalese attack on his position, which vividly depicts the mingled horror and fury awakened in German hearts by these black opponents. Quote, "They came, first singly, at wide intervals, filling their way like the arms of a horrible cuttlefish, eager, grasping, like the claws of a mighty monster. Thus they rushed closer, flickering and sometimes disappearing in the cloud, entire bodies and single limbs, now showing in the harsh glare, now sinking in the shadows, came nearer and nearer. Strong, wild fellows, their log-like, fat, black skulls wrapped in pieces of dirty rags, showing their grinning teeth like panthers, with their bellies drawn in and their necks stretched forward, some with bayonets on their rifles, many only armed with knives. Monsters all, in their confused hatred, frightful their distorted, dark grimaces, horrible their unnaturally wide-opened, burning, bloodshot eyes, eyes that seem like terrible beings themselves, like unearthly, hell-born beings, eyes that seem to run ahead of their owners, lashed, unchained, no longer to be restrained. On they came like dogs gone mad and cats spitting and yowling, with a burning lust for human blood, with a cruel dissemblance of their beastly malice. Behind them came the first wave of the attackers, in close order, a solid, rolling black wall, rising and falling, swaying and heaving, impenetrable, endless." End quote. Here again is the proposal of a British officer to raise a million black savages from England's African colonies for use on the Western Front. Major Stuart Steffens exults in Britain's, quote, "almost unlimited reservoir of African manpower," end quote. In northern Nigeria alone, he remarks, there are today more than 700,000 warlike tribesmen. Quote, "Let them be used," end quote, says the major. Quote, "These bonny fetchers are now engaged in the pastoral arts of peace, but I would make bold to assert that a couple of 100,000 could, after 6 months' training, be usefully employed in daredevil charges into German trenches," end quote. Major Stuart Steffens hopes that at least the Sudanese battalions will be transferred en masse to the Western Front. This, he concludes, quote, "would mean the placing at once in the trenches of, say, 70,000 big, lusty, coal-black devils, the time of whose life is the wielding of the bayonet, and whose advent would not be regarded by the Boches as a pleasing omen of more to come of the same sort." End quote. The military possibilities are truly engaging. There are literally tens of millions of fighting blacks and scores of millions of fighting Asiatics now living under white rule who could conceivably be armed and shipped to European battlefields. After which, of course, Europe, the white homeland, would be a queer place. Fortunately for our race, the late war did not see this sort of thing carried to its logical conclusion, but the harm done was bad enough. The white world grew accustomed to the use of colored mercenaries and to the contracting of alliances with colored peoples against white opponents as a mere matter of course. The German war mind, in particular, teemed with colored alliance projects. Unable to compete with the Allies in getting colored troops to Europe, Germans planned to revenge themselves in other fields. The Turkish alliance and the resulting Holy War proclamation were hailed with delight. Quote, "Over there in Turkey," end quote, wrote the well-known German publicist Ernst Jaeck, quote, "stretch Anatolia and Mesopotamia. Anatolia, the land of the sunrise. Mesopotamia, the region of ancient paradise. May these names be to us a sign. May this world war bring to Germany and Turkey the sunrise and the paradise of a new time. may it confer upon an absurd Turkey and a greater Germany the blessing of a fruitful Turco-Teutonic collaboration in peace after a victorious Turco-Teutonic collaboration in war. End quote. The scope of Germany's Asiatic aspirations during the war is exemplified by an article from the pen of the learned Orientalist Professor Bernhard Molden. Germany's aid to Turkey, contends Professor Molden, is merely symptomatic of her policy to raise the other Asiatic peoples now crushed beneath English and Russian domination. Thus, Germany will create puissant allies for the Second Punic War. Germany must therefore strive to solidify the great Central Asian bloc, Turkey, Persia, Afghanistan, China. Professor Molden urges a pan-Asian railroad from Constantinople to Peking. This should be especially alluring to Afghanistan, which would thereby become one of the great pivots of world politics and trade. In fine, quote, Germany must free Asia, end quote. As another prominent German writer, Friedrich de Lichts, wrote in similar vein, quote, to renovate the East, such is Germany's mission, end quote. In such a mood, Germans hailed Japan's absence of genuine hostility with the greatest satisfaction. The gust of rage which swept Germany at Japan's seizure of Kiao Chau was soon allayed by numerous writers preaching reconciliation and eventual alliance with the mistress in the Far East. Typical of this pro-Japanese propaganda is an article by Herr J. Witt, a former official in the Far East, which appeared in 1915. Herr Witt chides his countrymen for their talk about the yellow peril. Such a peril may exist in the future, but it is not pressing at this moment. Quote, at any rate for us Germans, who have no great territorial possessions in the Far East, we might permit ourselves to speak of a yellow peril if there was a white solidarity. This, however, does not exist. We are learning this just now by bitter experience on our own flesh and blood. Our foes have marshaled peoples of all races against us in battle. So long as this helps them, all race antipathies and race interests are to them matters of supreme indifference. Under these circumstances, in the midst of a life and death struggle against the peoples of the white race, shall we play the role of guardian angel of these peoples against the yellow peoples? For us, as Germans, there is now only one supreme life interest to which all other interests must be subordinated, the safety and advancement of Germany and of Deutschland in the world. End quote. Herr Witt therefore advocates a, quote, close political understanding between Germany and Japan. In future, we can accomplish nothing in the teeth of Japan. Therefore, we must get on good terms with Japan. And we can do it, too. Germany is, in fact, the country above all others who in the future has the best prospect of allying herself advantageously with the Far Eastern peoples. End quote. And so it went throughout the war years, both sides using all possible colored aid to down the white foe, both sides alike reckless of the ultimate racial consequences. In fact, leaving ultimate consequences aside, many persons feared during the later phases of the war that Europe might be headed for immediate dissolution. As early as mid-1916, Lord Loreburn expressed apprehension lest the war was entailing general bankruptcy and, quote, such a destruction of the male youth of Europe as will break the thin crust of civilization which has been built up since the Dark Ages, end quote. These fears were intensified by the Russian Revolution of 1917. With its hideous corollary of Bolshevism, which definitely triumphed before the close of that year. The Bolshevik triumph evoked despairing predictions like Lord Lansdowne's. Quote, we are not going to lose this war, but its prolongation will spell ruin for the civilized world. End quote. Well, the war was prolonged for another year, ending in the triumph of the Allies and America, though leaving Europe in the deplorable condition reviewed in the preceding chapter. The hopes of mankind were now centered on the peace conference, but these hopes were over-sanguine, for the Versailles settlement was riddled with political and economic imperfections from the Tsar to Shantung. This was what a skeptical minority had feared from the first. At the very beginning of the war, for instance, the French publicist Urbain Goehier had predicted that when the diplomats gathered at the end of the conflict, they would find the problem of constructive settlement insoluble. Most persons, however, had been more hopeful. Disappointment and disillusionment were therefore correspondingly intense. The majority of liberal-minded, forward-looking men and women throughout the world deplored the Versailles settlement's faulty character. Some, however, accepting the situation as the best of a bad business, others entirely repudiating it on the ground that by crystallizing an intolerable status, it would entail worse disasters in the near future. General Smuts, the South African delegate to the conference, well represents the first attitude. In a formal protest against the Versailles settlement, General Smuts stated, quote, "I have signed the peace treaty, not because I consider it a satisfactory document, but because it is imperatively necessary to close the war. Because the world needs peace above all, and nothing could be more fatal than the continuance of the state of suspense between war and peace." The 6 months since the armistice was signed have, perhaps, been as upsetting, unsettling, and ruinous to Europe as the previous 4 years of war. I look upon the peace treaty as the close of these two chapters of war and armistice, and only on that ground do I agree to it. I say this now, not in criticism, but in faith, not because I wish to find fault with the work done, but rather because I feel that in the treaty we have not yet achieved the real peace to which our peoples were looking, and because I feel that the real work of making peace will only begin after this treaty has been signed, and a definite halt has thereby been called to the destructive passions that have been desolating Europe for nearly 5 years. End quote. The English economist J. L. Garvin, who, like General Smuts, accepted the treaty faute de mieux, makes these trenchant comments upon the settlement itself. Quote, "Derisive human genius, surveying with pity and laughter the present state of mankind, and some of the obsolete means adopted at Paris to remedy it, might do most good by another satire like Rabelais, Gulliver, or Candide. But let us put from us here the temptation to conjure up vistas of the grotesque. Let us pursue these plain studies in common sense. A treaty, even when signed, is paper. It is in itself inoperative without the action or control of living forces which it seeks to express or repress. Treaties not drawn against sound and certain assets may be dishonored in the sequel like bad checks or bills. You do not get peace merely by putting it on paper. And, much more to the point, all that is called peace does not necessarily spell prosperity any more than all that glitters is gold. You can make a solitude and call it peace. The quintessence of death or stupefaction resembles a kind of peace. You can prolong relative stagnation and depression and yet say that it is peace. But that would not be the reconciling and lasting, the constructive and the creative peace, as it was visioned by the Allied peoples in their greatest moments of insight and inspiration during the war. For that higher and wiser thing we lavished our pent-up energies and the accumulated treasure of 100 years and sent so many of our best to die." End quote. The veteran student of world politics, Dr. E. J. Dillon, put the matter succinctly when he wrote, quote, "The peace is being made not as originally projected on the basis of the 14 points, nor on the lines of territorial equilibrium, but by a compromise which misses the advantage of either and combines certain evils of both. The treaty has failed to lay the axe to the roots of war, has perhaps increased their number while purporting to destroy them. The germs of future conflicts, not only between the recent belligerents, but also between other groups of states, are numerous, and if present symptoms may be trusted, will sprout up in the fullness of time." End quote. The badness of the Versailles treaties is nowhere more manifest than in the way they have alienated idealistic support and enthusiasm from the inchoate League of Nations. Multitudes of persons, once zealous leaguers, now feel that the League has no moral foundation. Such persons contend that even were the covenant theoretically perfect, the League could no more succeed on the basis of the present peace settlement than a flawlessly designed palace could be erected if superimposed upon a quicksand. Europe is thus in evil case. Her statesmen have failed to formulate a constructive settlement. Old problems remain unsolved while fresh problems arise. The danger is redoubled by the fact that both Europe and the entire world are faced with a new peril, Bolshevism. the menace of Bolshevism is simply incalculable. Bolshevism is a peril in some ways unprecedented in the world's history. It is not merely a war against a social system, not merely a war against our civilization. It is a war of the hand against the brain. For the first time since man was man, there is a definite schism between the hand and the head. Every principle which mankind has thus far evolved, community of interest, the solidarity of civilization and culture, the dignity of labor, of muscle, of brawn, dominated and illuminated by intellect and spirit, all these Bolshevism howls down and tramples in the mud. Bolshevism's cardinal tenets, the dictatorship of the proletariat, and the destruction of the classes by social war, are of truly hideous import. The classes, as conceived by Bolshevism, are very numerous. They comprise not merely the idle rich, but also the whole of the upper and middle social strata, the land-owning country folk, the skilled working men. In short, all except those who work with their untutored hands, plus the elect few who philosophize for those who work with their untutored hands. The effect of such ideas, if successful, not only on our civilization, but also on the very fiber of the race, can be imagined. The death or degradation of nearly all persons displaying constructive ability and the tyranny of the ignorant and antisocial elements would be the most gigantic triumph of dysgenics ever seen. Beside it, the ill effects of war would pale into insignificance. Civilization would wither like a plant stricken by blight, while the race, summarily drained of its good blood, would sink like lead into the depths of degenerate barbarism. This is precisely what is occurring in Russia today. Bolshevism has ruled Russia less than 3 years, and Russia is ruined. She ekes out a bare existence on the remains of past accumulations, on the surviving scraps of her material and spiritual capital. Everywhere are hunger, cold, disease, terror, physical and moral death. The proletariat is making its clean sweep. The classes are being systematically eliminated by execution, massacre, and starvation. The racial impoverishment is simply incalculable. Meanwhile, Lenin, surrounded by his Chinese executioners, sits behind the Kremlin walls, a modern Genghis Khan plotting the plunder of a world. Lenin's Chinese braves are merely symptomatic of the intrigues which Bolshevism is carrying on throughout the non-white world. Bolshevism is, in fact, as anti-racial as it is anti-social. To the Bolshevik mind, with its furious hatred of constructive ability and its fanatical determination to enforce leveling proletarian equality, the very existence of superior biological values is a crime. Bolshevism has vowed the proletarianization of the world, beginning with the white peoples. To this end, it not only foments social revolution within the white world itself, but it also seeks to enlist the colored races in its grand assault on civilization. The rulers of Soviet Russia are well aware of the profound ferment now going on in colored lands. They watch this ferment with the same terrible glee that they watched the Great War and the fiasco of Versailles, and they plot to turn it to the same profit. Accordingly, in every quarter of the globe, in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the United States, Bolshevik agitators whisper in the ears of discontented colored men their gospel of hatred and revenge. Every nationalist aspiration, every political grievance, every social discrimination is fuel for Bolshevism's hellish incitement to racial as well as to class war. And this Bolshevik propaganda has not been in vain. Its results already show in the most diverse quarters, and they are ominous for the future. China, Japan, Afghanistan, India, Java, Persia, Turkey, Egypt, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Mexico, and the Black Belt of our own United States. Here is a partial list of the lands where the Bolshevik leaven in color is clearly at work. Bolshevism thus reveals itself as the arch-enemy of civilization and the race. Bolshevism is the renegade, the traitor within the gates, who would betray the citadel, degrade the very fiber of our being, and ultimately hurl a rebarbarized, racially impoverished world into the most debased and hopeless of mongrelizations. Therefore, Bolshevism must be crushed out with iron heels, no matter what the cost. If this means more war, let it mean more war. We know only too well war's dreadful toll, particularly on racial values. But what war losses could compare with the losses inflicted by the living death of Bolshevism? There are some things worse than war, and Bolshevism stands foremost among those dread alternatives. So ends our survey of the white world as it emerges from the Great War. The prospect is not a brilliant one. Weakened and impoverished by Armageddon, handicapped by an unconstructive peace, and facing internal Bolshevist disaffection, which must at all costs be mastered, the white world is ill-prepared to confront the rising tide of color. What that tide portends will be the subject of the concluding chapters. Part 3. The Deluge on the Dikes. Chapter 10. The Outer Dikes. In my first chapter, I showed that the rising tide of color today finds itself confronted by dikes erected by the white race during the centuries of its expansion. The reader will also remember that white expansion has taken two forms, settlement and political control. These two phases differ profoundly in character. Areas of settlement like North America have become integral portions of the white world. On the other hand, regions of political control, like India, are merely white dependencies, highly valuable perhaps, yet in the last analysis held by title of the sword. Between these clearly contrasted categories lies an intermediate class of territories typified by South Africa, where whites have settled in large numbers without displacing the native populations. Lastly, there exist certain white territories which may be called enclaves. These enclaves have become thoroughly white by settlement, yet they are so distant from the main body of the white world and so contiguous to colored race areas that white tenure does not possess that security which settlement and displacement of the aborigines normally confer. Australia typifies this anomalous class of races. The white defenses against the colored tide can be divided into what may be termed the outer and the inner dikes. The outer dikes, the regions of white political control, contain no settled white population, so that their abandonment, whatever the political or economic loss, would not directly affect white race integrity. The question of their retention or abandonment should therefore, save in a few exceptional cases, be judged by political, economic, or strategic considerations. The inner dikes, the areas of white settlement, however, are a very different matter. Peopled as they are, wholly or largely by whites, they have become parts of the race heritage, which should be defended to the last extremity no matter if the costs involved are greater than their more economic values would warrant. They are the true bulwarks of the race, the patrimony of future generations who have a right to demand of us that they shall be born white in a white man's land. Ill will it fare if ever our race should close its ears to this most elemental call of the blood. Then, indeed, would be manifest the writing on the wall. That issue, however, is reserved for the next chapter. Let us here examine the matter of the outer dikes, the regions of white political control. There, where the white man is not settler but suzerain, his suzerainty should, in the last analysis, depend on the character of the inhabitants. Right here, let us clear away the doctrinaire pedantry that commonly obscures discussion about the retention or abandonment of white political control over racially non-white regions. Argument usually tends to crystallize around two antitheses. On the one side are the doctrinaire liberals, who maintain the imprescriptible right of every human group to attain independence and of every sovereign group to retain independence. On the opposite side are the doctrinaire imperialists, who maintain the equally imprescriptible right of their particular nation to vital expansion, regardless of injuries thereby inflicted upon other nations. Now, I submit that both these assumptions are unwarranted. There is no imprescriptible right to either independence or empire. It depends on the realities of each particular case. The extreme cases at either end of the scale can be adjudged offhand by ordinary common sense. No one except a doctrinaire liberal would be likely to assert that the Andaman Islanders had an imprescriptible right to independence, or that Haiti, which owed its independence only to a turn in European politics, should forever remain a sovereign international nuisance. On the other hand, the whole world, with the exception of Teutonic imperialists, denounced Germany's attempt to swallow highly civilized Belgium as a crime against humanity. In other words, realities, not abstract theories, decide. That does not please the doctrinaires who insist on setting up Procrustean beds of theory on which realities should be racked or crammed. It does, however, conform to the dictates of nature, which decree that what is attuned shall live while the disharmonic and degenerate shall pass away. And nature usually has the last word. Surveying the regions of white political control over non-white peoples in the realistic way, thereby avoiding the pitfalls of doctrinaire theory and blind prejudice, we may arrive at a series of conclusions which, though lacking the trim symmetry of the ideologue, will correspond to the facts of the various cases. One thing is certain, the white man will have to recognize that the practically absolute world dominion which he exercised during the 19th century can no longer be maintained. Largely because of that very dominion, colored races have been drawn out of their traditional isolation and have been quickened by white ideas, while the life-conserving nature of white rule has everywhere favored colored multiplication. These factors have combined to produce a widespread ferment which has been clearly visible for the past 2 decades and which is destined to grow more acute in the near future. This ferment would have developed even if the Great War had never occurred. However, the white world's weakening through Armageddon has immensely accelerated the process and has opened up the possibility of violent shortcuts, which would have mutually disastrous consequences. Especially has it evoked in bellicose and fanatical minds the vision of a pan-colored alliance for the universal overthrow of white hegemony at a single stroke, a dream which would turn into a nightmare of race war, beside which the late struggle in Europe would seem the veriest child's play. The effective centers of colored unrest are the brown and yellow worlds of Asia. Both these worlds are not merely in negative opposition to white hegemony, but are experiencing a real renaissance whose genuineness is best attested by the fact that it is a faithful replica of similar movements in past times. White men must get out of their heads the idea that Asiatics are necessarily inferior. As a matter of fact, while Asiatics do not seem to possess that sustained constructive power with which the whites, particularly the Nordics, are endowed, the browns and yellows are yet gifted peoples who have profoundly influenced human progress in the past and who undoubtedly will contribute much to world civilization. The Asiatics have, by their own efforts, built up admirable cultures, rooted in remote antiquity and worthy of all respect. They are today once more displaying their innate capacity by not merely adopting, but adapting, white ideas and methods. That this profound Asiatic Renaissance will eventually result in the substantial elimination of white political control from Anatolia to the Philippines is as natural as it is inevitable. This does not mean a precipitate white scuttle from Asia. Far from it. It does mean, however, a candid facing of realities and a basing of policy on realities rather than on prepositions or prejudices. Unless the white man does this, he will injure himself more than anyone else. If Asia is today really renascent, Asia will ultimately reap the political fruits. Men worthy of independence will sooner or later get independence. This is as certain as is the converse truth that men unworthy of independence, though they cry for it never so loudly, will either remain subject or will quickly relapse into subjugation should they, by some lucky circumstance, obtain what they could only misuse. If, then, Asia deserves to be free, she will be free. The only question is, how she will attain her freedom. Shall it be an evolutionary process, in the main peaceful, based upon mutual respect, with mutual recognition of both increasing Asiatic fitness and white vested interests? Or shall it come through cataclysmic revolution? This is the dilemma which these imperialists should ponder, who object to any relaxation of white political control over Asia because of the value of the subject regions. That white control over Asiatic lands has been, and still is, immensely profitable cannot be denied. But what basis for this value is there except lack of effective opposition? If real, sustained opposition now develops, if subject Asia becomes chronically rebellious, if its peoples resolutely boycott white goods, as China and India have shown Asiatics capable of doing, will not white control be transformed from an asset into a liability? Above all, let us remember that no race values are involved. No white race areas would have to be abandoned to non-white domination. White control over Asia is political, and can thus be judged by the criteria of material interest undisturbed by the categorical imperative of race duty. The need for sympathetic open-mindedness toward awakening Asia, if cataclysmic disasters are to be averted, becomes all the clearer when we realize that on important issues lying outside Asia, the white world must resolutely oppose Asiatic desires. We whites should be the more generous in our attitude toward Asia, because imperative reasons of self-protection require us to deny the Asiatics some of their best opportunities in the outer world. In my opening chapters, I discussed the rapid growth of Asiatic populations and the resultant steadily augmenting outward thrust of surplus Asiatics, principally yellow men, but also in lesser degree brown men, from overcrowded homelands toward the less crowded regions of the earth. It is in fact Asiatics, and above all Mongolian Asiatics, who form the first waves of the rising tide of color. Unfortunately, the white world cannot permit this rising tide free scope. White men cannot, under peril of their very race existence, allow wholesale Asiatic immigration into white race areas. This prohibition, which will be discussed in the next chapter, is already a serious blow to Asiatic aspirations. But the matter does not end there. The white world also cannot permit with safety to itself wholesale Asiatic penetration of non-Asiatic colored regions like Black Africa and tropical Latin America. To permit Asiatic colonization and ultimate control of these vast territories with their incalculable resources would be to overturn in favor of Asia the political, the economic, and eventually the racial balance of power in the world. At present, the white man controls these regions, and he must stand fast. No other course is possible. Neither Black Africa nor mongrel-ruled tropical America can stand alone. If the white man goes, the Asiatic comes. Browns to Africa, yellows to Latin America. And there is no reason under heaven why we whites should deliberately present Asia with the richest regions of the tropics to our own impoverishment and probable undoing. Our race duty is therefore clear. We must resolutely oppose both Asiatic permeation of white race areas and Asiatic inundation of those non-white, but equally non-Asiatic, regions inhabited by the really inferior races. But we should also recognize that by taking this attitude, we debar Asiatics from golden opportunities and render impossible the realization of aspirations intrinsically just as normal and laudable as our own. And, having closed in their faces so many doors of hope, can we refuse to discuss with gifted and capable Asiatics the problem of turning over to them the keys of their own house, without causing festering hatreds whose poison may spread far beyond Asia into other colored lands, and possibly into white lands as well? Neither a pan-colored nor a colored Bolshevist alliance are impossibilities, far-fetched though these terms may sound. The fact is, we whites are in no position to indulge in the luxury of Bourbonism. Weakened by Armageddon, hampered by Versailles, and harnessed by Bolshevism, the white world can ill afford to flout legitimate Asiatic aspirations to independence. Our imperialists may argue that this means abandoning outer dikes, but I contend that white positions in Asia are not protective dikes, but strategic blockhouses, built upon the sands during the long Asiatic ebb tide, in which the now rising Asiatic waves must ultimately engulf. Is it not the part of wisdom to quit these outposts before they collapse into the swirling waters? Our true outer dikes stand, not in Asia, but in Africa and Latin America. Let us not exhaust ourselves by stubborn resistance in Asia, which in the end must prove futile. Let us conserve our strength, remembering that by the time Asia has been submerged, the flood should have lost much of its pent-up power, particularly should this be true of the moral imponderables. By taking a reasonable, conciliatory attitude toward Asiatic aspirations to independence, we would thereby eliminate the moral factors in Asia's present hostility toward ourselves. Many Asiatics would still be our foes from resentment at Balt expansion, but we should have separated the sheep from the goats, and the sheep are the more numerous. There are, of course, irreconcilables like Japanese imperialists and pan-Islamic fanatics who would like to upset the whole world. However, taken by the large, Asia is peopled neither by fire-eating jingoes nor howling dervishes. The average Asiatic is by nature less restless, less ambitious, and consequently less aggressive than ourselves. Today, Asiatics are everywhere aroused by a whole complex of stimuli, like overcrowding, white domination, and white denial of nationalistic aspirations, to an access of hatred and fury. Those last-mentioned stimuli to anti-white hostility we can remove. The first-mentioned cause of hostility, overpopulation, we cannot remove. Only the Asiatic himself can do that by controlling his reckless procreation. Of course, overpopulation is of itself a sufficiently seriously provoker of trouble. There is no more certain breeder of strife than the expansive urge of a fast-breeding people. Nevertheless, this hostile stimulus applies primarily to yellow Asia. Brown Asia, once free or clearly on the road to freedom, would be neither satisfied or engrossed in its intestine broils. At any rate, the twin specters of a pan-Asian or a pan-colored alliance would probably vanish like a mirage of the desert, and the white world would be far better able to deal with yellow pressure on its race frontiers. No light task, weakened and distracted as the white world finds itself today. Unfortunately, no such wise foresight seems to have been vouchsafed our statesmen. Imperialistic secret treaties formed the basis for Versailles' treatment of Asiatic questions, and those treaties were drawn precisely as though Armageddon were a skirmish, and Asia the sleeping giant of a century ago. Upon the brown world in particular, white domination was riveted rather than relaxed. This amazing disregard of present-day realities augurs ill for the future. Indeed, its evil first fruits are already apparent. The brown world, convinced that its aspirations can be realized only by force, turns to the yellow world and listens to Bolshevik propaganda, while pan-Islamism redoubles its efforts in Africa. Thus is once more manifest the diplomatic bankruptcy of Versailles. The white man, like King Canute, seats himself upon the tidal sands and bids the waves be stayed. He will be lucky if he escapes merely with wet shoes.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. That is our first audio segment. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free to dial in the number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty/1race. And that is the number 1. That address again, tiny.ty.cc/1race. Once you put in the address, click the link on the left side of the page. It says free vote line. When you click it, it will open a small window on your screen. The top line It is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943, and that's what you'll put on the second line, 564-943. Final line, you can enter a name. You can use your real name. You can use a nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get those three lines filled out, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You will be able to hear us. And it's the same procedure if you want to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do that, you'll hear the audio prompt to press the number 1. Do so. We will get you on the line. And again, if you read the debate between Dubois and Stoddard and you want to share on that, include commentary on that as we proceed, feel free to do so. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. Thomas Smith in New York. I've been paying attention to the archives, and I was able to listen in to the first half so far. And I really wanted to chime in on why I think Dr. Loving picked this book, and what I think is the significance of reading it. Is that okay?
Sure thing.
You know, I started writing this email to you what I thought, but it turned into like 10 pages. So I said, all right, chime in one day so I could just say it. I'm going to make it short. Someone kind of alluded to it last week. But for some reason, this white people seen a fear of Asian, Chinese, and I'm sort of beginning to India now, but in particular Chinese uprising. And Mr. Trump has been very outspoken about China manipulating their currency and other things. And I'm thinking, you're not right, even though we're trying to put this whole thing together. Look, that might be what's resonating with these white people with him. You know, it's not so much maybe the Mexican thing. You know, it might be the way that he's speaking very clearly about his ambitions toward getting these trade policies, getting tough on China. I can see that as being one of the driving forces behind him winning this election. It doesn't seem like they seem to be too concerned about the Africans, the Latin Americans. Their fear is that those people will get together with the brown and the yellow people, and those brown and yellow people will get those other people, you know, to a certain point where they're opposed to white people as well. So I think that hypocrisy could be alluding to, you know, this aggression toward China coming up with the white countries, in particular Russia and the United States, who seem to be pow-pow now with Trump. And that could be one of the reasons what Putin is automatically seeing him bored in China is that, listen, we got to do something. You know, it's about to be over. And I'll be my last thing.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everybody on the call. I was driving when I was listening to it, so I didn't really take notes. I'm putting everything off the top of my head. But the heart of the argument with Stoddard seems to be in this chapter about the Great War and why he has an issue with it because of the use of African soldiers from from the French and from other countries to kind of win this war. And then he even has an issue with the Germans using non-white people in regards to, you know, the Arabs or the Turks. So, you know, like I said, I think it's kind of like goes into the heart of his argument of, you know, the rising tide of color and why nations shouldn't be employing non-white people to fight their wars, and which was a big concern to him. It's interesting when he talked about the German people and how they weren't pure Nordic. He said he was, there were more Alpine people. I've also actually been doing some other Lappert started reading. I've been kind of like reading his book, Into the Darkness, where he took a trip to Germany during the World War II, and he basically says the same thing about how the German people are very mistaken about, you know, race and how they think that they're Nordic, and he doesn't really think so. So that was a pretty interesting comparison there, and seeing that same theme in his, you know, in this earlier book, and then he later expresses it in the book, Into the Heart of Darkness. The previous caller was talking about the fear of the yellow people. Wholeheartedly agree with him on that. Also, you know, going back to the beginning of the book and how the chapters were organized, it's interesting the way he organized it, where, you know, he started with the white man, then yellow man, and then the brown man, and then the black man, and then the red man. So it was sort of like, you know, that's the racial hierarchy on, you know, who's the more supreme and who's the least supreme. And I thought it was interesting that he put the red man as the lowest of the, you know, of the racial hierarchy, you know, and, you know, the black man is the second lowest, but, you know, I'm kind of understanding why he, you know, he's done that a little bit, but I think it'll probably be clearer, you know, if I take a glance over on why he considered that, but, that's about it off the top of my head. I'll mute my line.
Other folks that we haven't heard from have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, to Thomas in New York, and the other callers and listeners. Wow, this is an interesting read. I wanted to start actually at the very beginning. It's on page 114. Mr. Stoddard writes here, he says, white race consciousness has been, of course, perturbed by numberless internal frictions, which have at times produced partial inhibitions of unitary feeling. Nonetheless, when really faced by non-white opposition, white men have in their past instinctively tended to close their ranks against the common foe. One of the Great War's most deplorable results has been an unprecedented weakening of white solidarity, which, if not repaired, may produce the most dangerous consequences. And the standout line is the second sentence, where he says, nevertheless, when really faced by non-white opposition, white men have in the past instinctively tended to close their ranks against the common foe. To me, that is the great challenge of non-white people, and most specifically black people. Even if we don't always get along, which is why I like the whole idea of united and dependent, thank you, Neely Fuller Jr., for such a brilliant concept, we have to learn to close ranks against the common foe and be able to understand that our eternal enemies have manipulated us against each other for way too long. And if we can do what they do and have done and continue to do right now, and they're doing it with an understanding of their genetic annihilation being the end result of their inability to come together against a common foe, even if they're in a state of disagreement with one another, that is the greatest thing that we have to learn from white people, is that for our physical and actual survival, as well as genetic survival, because they're killing us on every front possible, that we're going to have to start doing the same thing. And I think that is a very important lesson for us to garner from the text. That's one line in particular. excuse me, on page 120, he writes, Yes, he writes here, I like the way he elucidates the way that they view black people. He says on 120, here is a German officer's account of a Senegalese attack on his position, which vividly depicts the mingled horror and fury awakened in German hearts by these black opponents. They came first singly at wide intervals, feeling their way like the arms of a horrible cuttlefish, eagerly grasping like the claws of a mighty monster. Thus they rushed closer, flickering and sometimes disappearing in the cloud, entire bodies and single limbs now showing in the harsh glare, now sinking in the shadows, came nearer and nearer. Strong, wild fellows, their log-like, fat, black skulls, wrapped in pieces of dirty rags, showing their grinning teeth like panthers, with their bellies drawn in and their necks stretched forward, some with bayonets on their rises. Many only armed with knives, monsters all, in their confusion, their confused hatred. Frightful, their distorted, dark grimaces, horrible, their unnaturally wide, open, burning, bloodshot eyes, eyes that seem like terrible beings themselves, like unearthly, hell-born beings, eyes that seem to run ahead of their owners, lashed, unchained, no longer to be restrained. On they came like dogs gone mad and cats spitting and yowling with a burning lust for human blood, with a cruel dissemblance of their beastly malice. Behind them came the first wave of the attackers in close order, a solid, rolling, black wall, rising and falling, swaying and heaving, impenetrable and endless. And that description takes me to shows like The Walking Dead, shows like The Strain, all of the shows in which, even Alien. I remember they had a scene in Alien versus Predator where it looked like millions of these black aliens were just crawling all over this pyramid, and it looked just like an infestation of insects. And that's the way that we're described by that particular section. And to me, that is a great example of how they see us, like these just hordes of like insects to be crushed and destroyed wherever they find us. And to me, this kind of description lends a lot to what we see in horror movies, where the creatures or the beings that are supposed to be the vectors of disease or horror itself are black, or they blacken them so that they look like black people, and then they just basically go on a killing spree of killing everything that looks like a zombie or a vampire or whatever other creature that they conjure up. So I think that was a very telling paragraph. I also like the map on page 125 that discusses or depicts where white people have taken over. Kind of gives a good idea of how a cancer infects the body, how white people have infected the planet with their white supremacist disease, trails of terror that they've left around the planet. And lastly, there was a section of 133 where he wrote something I found very telling as well. And he starts, "In my opening chapters, I discussed the rapid growth of Asiatic populations and the resultant steady augmenting outward thrust of surplus Asiatics, principally yellow men, but in a lesser degree, brown men from overcrowded homelands toward the less crowded regions of the earth. It is, in fact, Asiatics and above all Mongolian Asiatics who formed the first waves of the rising tide of color. Unfortunately, the white world cannot permit this rising tide free scope. White men cannot, under peril of their very race existence, allow wholesale Asiatic immigration into white race areas. This prohibition, which will be discussed in the next chapter, is already a serious blow to Asiatic aspiration. But the matter does not end there. The white world also cannot permit with safety to itself wholesale Asiatic penetration of non-Asiatic colored regions like Black Africa and tropical Latin America. To permit Asiatic colonization and ultimate control of these vast territories with their incalculable resources would be to overturn in favor of Asia the political and the economic and eventually the racial balance of power in the world. At present, the white man controls these regions, and he must stand fast. No other course is possible. Either Black Africa nor Mongol-ruled tropical America can stand alone. If the white man goes, the Asiatic comes. Browns to Africa, yellows to Latin America, and there is no reason under heaven why we whites should deliberately present Asia with the richest regions of the tropics to our own impoverishment and probable undoing." And I found that prediction very interesting because today China is now all over the African continent. They did not come as a military party. They came there to facilitate trade and business, even though the role that they have played in Africa has not always been a positive one. The idea is that they did come there peacefully and have effectively formulated quite a few strong relationships with different African countries. I find it interesting he also speaks about not allowing Asiatics into white areas, which is exactly what white people have done today by destroying places like Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and all of these groups of people, including North Africans, are traveling to these white countries now and have now set up quite a hefty numbers in these regions. So a lot of what he predicted is exactly what's happening, and now they're trying to stop the rising tide of, I guess they would call it, Middle Eastern terror in that region due to the fact that they've allowed the people they brutalized to emigrate to those regions. So I find his predictions very interesting in that section of the text. Thank you very much, and I'll meet my line there.
Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free. Did we get everybody? Anybody else have commentary? Okay, I'll assume we nabbed everyone. If folks have a hand that they would like to, or comment rather, that they would like to share, get a hand up. Please don't wait until the last of the program. I'll share some of our editor, Mel, some of her observations as well. I thought we had a few doozies during this week's segment of the reading, some of the notes that I took. Let's see. Okay. Going back to the first portion of the reading, and we are getting close to the end. I think I said this earlier this week. I'm not sure if it was on either of the programs yesterday, but I know I have stated that we are closing on the end of this book a little quicker than I thought. So we might have three sessions left in the read. We'll kind of, you know, see how fast it goes. It might not even be three. It might only be two. So be thinking of next book to read. If I was just going to pick, I would pick Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, deals with racism. Some people already said that they would be down to read that. People have other thoughts. That's fine, too. I was going to pick something that was a little more fun because this is more of a dense read. But just have that in mind since we are closing on the end of this text. Okay. So some of the things that I picked out for this week, some of the things that I made note of. I think Ross and some of the other folks that already picked up when he talks about the first chapter, chapter 9, about white solidarity, that whites, when they've been faced by a threat, that they respond instinctively to close ranks against a common non-white foe. Even if there is some instinctual basis, I think whites, they invest a lot of time and energy training, grooming, preparing whites to go out and function as race soldiers. We've talked about this before. I'm of the opinion it could be both. Where whites, there's some genetic component that compels them to function in this manner, and some of that might even be underlying. Some people have said that that sounds like white genetic annihilation, that there's a genetic component motivating them to terrorize people who have melanin, greater, larger amount of melanin. But even if, you know, that's not it entirely, white people, they make sure that their children, daughters and sons, that they are going to grow up to make sure that they continue the practice of racism, white supremacy, so they know their roles. Where he talks about the rivalries and brawls that have happened between whites and how that has been a problem. In my view, the thing that has unified whites, I've talked about this before, there is no white fraternity. They abuse and rape and pillage each other. The thing that bonds them is white genetic annihilation and unifying around the abuse of black people. That has been the last 8 years with President Obama. That's how President Trump, if anything, that's something that I thought about, right? I'm saying that all of this was on the same, all of this was the final Creswell-Zing Institute lecture, right, where she talks about Stoddard's book repeatedly throughout that lecture and where she made the prediction that Donald Trump was going to win. Dr. Welsing, I don't know what you would have said about that, but in my view, this is like historic white unification, the way that they have responded with the election and getting so many white people, including white women, to go out and support one candidate and their conduct over the last almost decade and how they have coalesced to obstruct, vilify, attack President Obama, black people at large. Moving forward, let's see, when he talks about the that white part of the white solidarity is there should be some sort of happiness or pleasure around seeing non-white people mimicking, copying the concepts that whites have put forward. He says that the Palestinians, they have taken their laws from Greece and civil law from Rome and all of this. And in my view, it really enforces the importance of us thinking for ourselves and as much as possible rejecting white supremacist concepts and ways of thinking about the world and white supremacist values. That in and of itself works against the system of white supremacy. That's why, you know, divesting from holidays, that right there, progress. Where he says, he refers to whites as barbarians. He did that a few times this week, right in the paragraph below, where he talks about non-white people around the world appropriating racist concepts. He says, the researchers of European scholars identified the founders of our civilization with a race of tall, white-skinned barbarians. It seems like that might be a bit of honesty slipping through. And then a few times he says the penalty of a failure of whites to remain unified about maintaining white global supremacy is they could regress to barbarism if they don't do this. And I kept saying regress, the system of white supremacy. The system of white supremacy is barbarism every day. What else do you call this? Worldwide lynchings and rapings and castrations and finding new ways to torture and maim and brutalize people just because they have melanin. Let's see, moving forward. Where he challenges, I thought it was interesting when he where he talks about this pan-Slavism, the Eastern Wing led by Prince Utomsky and other chauvinists of his ilk went so far in its imperialistic obsession as actually to deny Russia's white blood. I thought that was significant because I've heard that sort of thing before when whites, when they have self-interest, where they know that they're going to be required to mistreat other individuals who are classified as white, they will just rebuke their whiteness. They will say, well, see, I can do this because these are not really white people. These are imposters, or they're really fake, or they've got, you know, Amos Wilson was, you know, this person's cousin or what have you, or I saw him hanging out with a Negro, whatever the case was. So they're not really white, so I can mistreat and do whatever I want to them. I've heard Mr. Fuller even submit that, speculate that that might have been what happened in Nazi Germany. But I've seen that sort of thing happen consistently, where if a white person wants to mistreat another individual who's classified as white, they'll just rebuke their white status. Continuing, let's see. This commentary around there are supposed to be rules, right, about how whites treat each other. Even if we get into a conflict, that means we're going to be killing whites, killing other whites. We're supposed to be rules about how we do this. We do this. We won't do this. We won't bring in Negroes from some other part of the world to come in and help us fight, you know, our white brethren. That was a huge, like, point of contention for whites in Germany, as he talked about. We had Raphael Scheck. He's a white man. He has written extensively about Nazi Germany. We talked about his book, Hitler's African Victims, and it gets confusing because there's one book that's Hitler's African Victims, and then there's a different book, Hitler's Black Victims. And we did both books. We had both authors on the program. Clarence Lussain is the author of the other book, but they're very similar titles, similar focus, just slight differences in what they talk about. But Raphael Scheck, white man, in his book, he describes in detail, and he has images of, they had like coins, talk about Joseph Goebbels and propaganda. They had like coins with pictures of huge black penises, Welsing moment with huge black penises. And the term, if you saw Ma'afa 21, which we referenced earlier, Madison Grant, they talk about this very book in Madison Grant. But they have images of what I'm talking about, saying, you know, they came in here and just raped us, and they brought in these niggers from the continent, and you just let them come in here, and they raped our women and left all these, you know, nigger Rhineland bastards. That's the title that they used. They left all these nigger babies around here. This is a disgrace. You're going to come in here and treat good white Germans white Nordics and white Alpine Germans. This is how you're going to come in here and treat us. He talked about how that resentment led all the way into World War II and bringing in African troops, and then how black troops were treated during World War II as well. But I thought that was also very interesting. And I mean, there's a lot of scholarship talking about this resentment for these non-white troops being brought in to police other black people. Let's see. The passage, I think Roz read some of it, where he captures, like, in vivid detail, seeing, like, whites destitute after they had been defeated and defeated by non-white people, and seeing these images. And, oh, this is so, it's so graphic. I downloaded that. So if you would like the full report, you can check it out. It is fascinating. I thought it was interesting that while I was trying to download that report, in the same, I think it's from like the History of the New York Times or some collection, but in the same volume, they had an article that was talking about German war crimes on the continent against black people, and some of the things that they were doing on the southern part of the continent that some, including myself, have likened to a rehearsal for the terrorist activities that were conducted during Nazi Germany. But you can download those articles. I'll make a post if you want the full article of describing these white captors or white captives of war and how bad it looked. And I think, too, that I know we have pointed out some of the times where you do not see an image of a white person, like they won't show images of white looters. Typically, it even reminded me of Jack Johnson when he had some of his infamous heavyweight championship fights, Jim Jeffries, back at the beginning of the 20th century. When Jack Johnson, first black heavyweight champion, when he would win, they would not even show the fight reel because whites would be so upset about seeing this loss and then taking it personal. This is not just an individual thing. This represents the entire white race. We heard that a lot, I think, in this week's section, that any advancement that whites make is for the greater good of all white people. And conversely, any losses that whites suffer, that is all of us. And I think that's something we've talked about. I think Roz emphasizes that in thinking of them as a global collective, collective organism. I know I have submitted that consistently, that the Voltron effect, or however you conceptualize it, whites work as a collective. They're not ignorant. They network, and this is on a global basis. If white supremacy starts having problems, non-white people are responding and behaving with some black self-respect and doing what we're supposed to do to solve this problem. Whites in other parts of the world see that they have a vested interest and helping the white women, the white men in that area where things are getting out of hand. They have a vested interest in seeing that being taken care of. I thought it was great to hear him just kind of lay all that out in explicit detail, because, I mean, that is, I'm not even sure that I have heard another white author, none that I can think of off the top of my head, maybe you have to give me a little while to think, just making it this clear. We are that vested in each other. This is way beyond like, I like you, or we're cool, or I love you, whatever that means. This is about white genetic survival, and the only way that we can do that is by recognizing we have to work together to dominate all of the non-white people on this planet. And failure to remain solidified in that effort, we're going to perish. Like, just making it so clear why I can see why Dr. Wilson would say this is required reading. I will get in two more things and then I'll check. I was just going to ask if people had a thought as to why he employs this metaphor throughout the course of the book. It's kind of a central theme of water, essentially the global white minority being drowned by the non-white melanin dominant population. Why is he sticking with this metaphor? Why is he using this metaphor of water and drowning to make his point about white genetic annihilation, white minority status on the planet? Last two quick points I'll get in. Talked about that. Let's see. Yeah, the two extremely vivid pieces of writing that he incorporated in the text this week, just amazing bits of literature that I think just really, I think what makes it so powerful is that both of those pieces really kind of get at the core of the white humiliation that this could happen, like the specter that this sort of thing could happen. It even sounded, when he was describing that, he got in
all of his jabs about the Haitian Revolution and what happened there, and even the disparaging, you know, these, you know, Negro savages in, you know, San Domingue, they would not have even been able to achieve this if we had not been quarreling amongst ourselves, like even placing some of the blame on whites for arguing with themselves. Same thing he did with the Russo-Japanese War, and saying that the Russians, they lost because you had whites not being focused on white solidarity and maintaining white domination. They were, you know, getting off into all these other silly ideologies and thinking about some form of nationalism where they specifically, their little clan, can dominate the world, and staying focused on the big picture, us as a global white minority working together to maintain white domination. Like, just really really important points, I thought, and how he presented, and as I said, those specific narratives about the defeat and the way the white captives, the white prisoners of war looked, and then the black troops being employed to come in and attack the Germans following World War One. Last thing, let's see. Oh, the diet. Yeah, that was, I already asked about that. Oh, yes, the metaphor. This is the one that I'll leave right here. When he says, no one except a doctrinaire liberal would be likely to assert that the Andaman Islanders had an imprescriptible right to independence, or that Haiti, which owed its independence only to a turn in European politics, should forever remain a sovereign international nuisance. I thought that was such a brilliant sentence to just capture his contempt and what he thinks about black people. Again, you don't hear this sort of thing expressed this, you know, openly, this flagrantly, that's the opinion of Haiti. And this is the sort of thing I think we should keep in mind. Any of the incidents that have happened there, the earthquake or Hurricane Matthew happening more recently this year, anything that happens in that part of the world, this is the type of sentiment that feeds how those images are projected to the world. Same type of sentiments that I think we heard earlier about maybe even they deserve whatever happened. If that means an earthquake and 100,000 black people died, whoop-de-doo. That's what's supposed to happen to those heathens because they couldn't behave themselves. I just thought that was a great sentence. And again, he was rejecting. He said all of that in response to rejecting this notion that there is some imprescriptible right to independence, right, in rejecting that. So he gives his view, and then the examples he gives further reinforce white supremacy. It's built on, I will just use this as an opportunity to further malign other groups of specific non-white people that I'm outraged about it. He must have a particular disgust for black people in Haiti because he wrote a whole book about them, which he has mentioned here. I'll pause there. We have our sound editor, Mel, with us to share some of her commentary. Again, our thanks to Universal Alien also. Mel, did you have commentary?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
That took too long.
Oh, can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Okay, so in Chapter 9, Stoddard discusses how some of the European countries deciding to use non-white or African soldiers in their wars was, I think, to their detriment. And so in a discussion with my partner earlier, we were talking about how a lot of white people, including white supremacists, constantly talk about the fall of Rome as being caused by the Romans deciding to use, I think, Germanic tribes or some outside white group in their wars. And it's my understanding that because of this usage of outsider groups to fight in their wars, that Rome fell because they became very weak. At least that's what I hear when I'm like watching history shows. And I think I heard Neely Fuller once talk about how a white supremacist he had heard who spoke in Washington, D.C. in I think the 60s or 70s. I think he was outside. He was talking about how the white supremacist was talking about how white people shouldn't let other people learn to do everything for them. Like, they shouldn't learn to depend on non-white people that they can't completely control, because you'll be left defenseless and weak if they should turn against you. So when I hear Stoddard talk about how his fellow white supremacists should not use these black soldiers, that's what came to my mind. That and white people's upsurgence in physical activity as a result of the Rocky films. Like, personally, I say fight your own wars, get as fit as you need for those, stop using other people, and it's no problem if you want to use the male fruit of your white culture. I mean, go right on ahead. this was already mentioned. I think this was literally just already mentioned on page 230. Men worthy of independence will sooner or later get independence. Very common justification I hear as well, that only the, I guess their way of interpreting the fittest survive. And also during a discussion earlier with my partner, I was reminded of this statement and how it's similar to a person deciding to hurt an old woman or a child rather than an Army veteran. Like, I don't believe that these are all choices that white people are making or white supremacists are making. On 231, the need, quote, the need for sympathetic open-mindedness toward awakening Asia if cataclysmic disasters are to be averted becomes all the clearer when we realize that on important issues lying outside Asia, the white world must absolutely oppose Asiatic desires. Okay, so the whole chapter 10 is really interesting to me personally. There's a whole Mother Jones article from last month with the, I guess he's now well-known, the alt-right, basic white supremacist, Richard Spencer, the guy who talked about how he doesn't care about justice or fairness and only cares about excellence and beauty and power, that guy. And the quote from the Mother Jones article where he's being interviewed says, quote, though Spencer now opposes interracial relationships, white nationalists have long looked east for inspiration. Hitler regarded Chinese and Japanese history as, quote, superior to our own, unquote. And I'm reminded that there's an entire Wikipedia page on like honorary Aryans, and I think that that's what the Japanese were considered. So this fixation with East Asian cultures, it's also said in the same Mother Jones article, is apparently something that, yeah, just white supremacists are constantly talking about. And my last point to answer your question was, I think the water is a powerful symbol for, I guess, fluidity, flexibility, and being able to adapt and, in my opinion, refine. I know in Taoism, the Chinese, I think you call it a religion, Taoism, water is really admired. There's a quote from the Tao Te Ching, the actual book about Taoism, that says water is fluid, soft and yielding, but water will wear away rock, which is rigid and cannot yield. As a rule, whatever is fluid, soft and yielding will overcome whatever is rigid and hard. And that is another paradox. What is soft is strong. And so I think he admires it because of, I guess, water's ability to just get into everything and eventually overcome if it's like in a large enough wave. Those are all my comments for now. My notes are so scattered. Thank you.
Right on. That is interesting, your interpretation of water, because that would seem to make it that white genetic annihilation is inevitable if water always wins.
Mm-hmm.
Other folks have commentary they wanted to share. Good to hear from Mel. Other comments they wanted to get in? Questions?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to quickly add, you know, you were talking about the leftovers from the black troops that were being used in the First World War and how the Germans treated them in Nazi Germany. I want to reference this book again because it's very interesting when you talked about that, the book that I referenced earlier, Into the Darkness, when Stoddard went over to Nazi Germany in, I think, in 1940. And he went to a eugenics court. Apparently the Nazi Germans had a eugenics court where they sterilized certain people that were unfit for the German people. And one of the people that he referenced in this eugenics court, he referenced him as an ape-like looking man. And I'm like, you know, that right there, like, raised my antennas. He must have been talking about a black man that they, you know, that the court had, you know, ruled to, you know, sterilize. So when you said that, I thought about that section of that book that, you know, book that I read. So that's all I wanted to add.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to answer your question about his use of the metaphor of water. I think that Mel's assessment was brilliant, and it makes perfect sense. I think the reason he does is it has a lot to do with genetic annihilation and the fact of the black gene being the dominant gene. It made me think of the description that I read earlier, the way that they described the Senegalese soldiers, in almost like a swarm. And I don't know if anyone's ever heard of a specific ant species called Siafu that is in Africa, and they're carnivorous ants that swarm basically whole sections of forest, and every living thing in their path, they basically swarm over them and tear them to shreds, and they've been known to kill and devour people. So even people have been known to have to leave certain areas, and they don't mind the ants because they already know about them culturally, as far as they understand what their purpose is. And when the ants come there, they basically clear their house of vermin. So the description is just that of so many black people with these powerful genes essentially absorbing white people to the point where they're no longer existent. So to me, it's almost like a metaphor for the complete loss of being white, what it means to be white from a genetic standpoint and in the physical world as far as lacking melanin. That's what I would take with water and add to what Mel so brilliantly put forth earlier. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. I'm trying to keep up because this is a little difficult text for me to read, but I took a couple of notes. I was reading and just listening, and he had a sentence that says, if then Asia deserves to be free, she will be free. The only question is how she will attain her freedom. Shall be an evolutionary process in the main peaceful, based upon mutual respect. And just when he said that, it was almost saying, well, are you proposing peace, or that you'll actually let people evolve without white interference? And I just don't think that that's possible. Now, obviously, the next line talks about cataclysmic revolution, but just based upon everything that I've been reading and just, you know, you guys are great and just helping me to learn and understand this stuff, white people like violence. And I just think that sentence there is totally hypocritical. I also just kept reading and just listening and started, basically, this whole book to me just talks about who says who is civilized. And I know this might sound simple, but he's not the creator, and white people didn't create themselves. So the whole argument of who determines who else is civilized is basically what this whole book is about. And I find that just very, very interesting. Even with all the research and all the other civilizations there, they use all these big words and jargon and just to go about saying, okay, we determine who else is civilized and who else is not. But in every turn that you see, they're constantly having sex with non-white people. They're constantly intermingling with them. And it's just the whole text is hypocritical. And then I was doing other research during the week about just Stoddard and his relationship to Grant. And you guys probably already discussed this. I didn't know it. I didn't know that Madison Grant was one of the major, what's that word that we like to use, lobbyists to have Otto Benga famously displayed in the Bronx Zoo. So all this stuff kind of makes sense, and it's just white people just want to dominate, and, you know, I just don't see that. I said it a couple weeks ago, they don't want peace, and even when they talk about they want peace, they would prefer, like he said, cataclysmic revolution, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm. One thing I did want to make sure I got in, that article, there is no author, right? When the presentation of the Negras are coming in, they're using black troops in the Rhinehold to attack white folks. There's no author listed, which stands out to me suspicious for one. But when you read it, I mean, it's like, I am suspicious. I know propaganda, right? If this is being written around the time of World War I, white people kill for fun. Infamous statement here on the cows, their appreciation for violence and war films. Even if there is not a present war, they'll make a movie about a war and people being blown up and fighting war, make a reenactment of the most recent war that we can recall. I mean, that thirst is there for violence, particularly violence against non-white people. I'm just going to read the last paragraph from this article because this wasn't in the text. Again, you can check out the whole thing if you're so interested. So the unnamed author, whoever is writing this, and just, I mean, this sounds like a fiction writer wrote this as a propaganda piece to me. Just see what you think. So the French defend themselves furiously. They hold the trench. The dead are heaped up before their ramparts, but keep it up. A wild passion takes possession of me. My revolver and my dagger have been lost in the fighting. I seize a bottle. Hell sends it to me at the right moment. Like an animal mad with hate, I rush forward. My bottle lands, crashing and splintering on a woolly skull with a distorted grimace. A hot shock rushes through my shoulder, a shock, a wrench. I grasp at the air, grasp something convulsively, throw myself in the air, and fall in a heap. A confused mist dances before my eyes. And that's how it ends. That just sounds a bit too flowery for me to... I don't know what this is. It might even be a fiction piece, but they just don't give enough details. There's no author listed. At the end of the day, just these images of cracking a bottle on some woolly-headed combatant just to me sounds like The Purge, 1912 style, making rejoicing about violence against a black person. And it just, the way that it's written, the language, it sounds suspicious. I'll stop there. The person who dialed in 9440, did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I thought it was interesting. Someone else mentioned this passage. It says, white men must get out of their heads the idea that Asiatics are necessarily inferior. As a matter of fact, while Asiatics do not seem to possess that sustained constructive power with which whites, particularly the Nordics, are endowed, The browns and yellows are yet gifted peoples who have profoundly influenced human progress. And so I thought that was a very, very interesting passage in that white supremacy, although they are at the top of that, they have a classical system, I guess, that cannot be ignored. And that classical system, I can see how that, for other non-whites, that causes confusion on their parts, especially when trying to find solidarity with one another. And so I thought that was just very interesting.
Also, the caller who talked about the what they perceived to be the hypocrisy or out-and-out deceit in saying that, you know, the white man must get this idea of Asians being inferior and all of that. To me, it sounded very much like refinement, that we don't have to be there in person directly. And it struck me because he was saying that, you know, there is some resentment towards white authority or white rule. But he says we can take care of that, which kind of stood out to be like, oh, that's no big deal. We know how to do the propaganda thing. We got that. We can change the way that people think about whites. We got that under control, which I have seen to be the case. Unfortunately, we have to do a better job about that. But I too interpreted that as we just have to be a bit more refined in how we do things, and it will look a little different. But all in all, you know, we'll still be running white domination still in effect. Anything else folks wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yeah.
Oh,
all right. You go ahead, brother. I'll go after you.
Oh, no. I actually thought Gus was going to mention this one, but that line where he says, and he puts it in parentheses, and he's talking about Haiti, and I have to laugh. He says, despite the legends which have grown up about the gaining of Haitian independence, and just when I read that, it and remembering who he's talking to, which is other white people, it's saying, hey, you know, you know these black people did not really do this. And that word legend almost was like, this really didn't happen. We kind of, it's like a basketball game. You know, they might have beat us, but we turned the ball over 93 times. and that's why they scored. But him using that word legend is almost like this is Paul Bunyan or the Loch Ness Monster, that black people could actually stand up for themselves and actually do something like this is highly unlikely. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Roz, but that's all I had.
Oh, no problem, no problem. Thanks for your addition to the conversation, because you just brought some great information, too. And I just wanted to chime in. When Gus was talking about white solidarity, it made me think of something that my wife experienced when she worked for in the fashion industry. She worked for a Jewish company, and on a number of occasions she had seen where the Syrian Jews had an issue with the Ashkenazi Jews in regards to some sort of, to different business dealings they had. And on a few occasions, she told me that one of the Syrian companies wanted to basically steal an employee from her company. And when they found out that her boss was Jewish, they immediately stopped it. And she said she heard them discuss the fact that they have an actual code as to how they deal with each other, that you could do whatever you want to anybody that's not Jewish. But if they're Jewish, they're off limits, even if they're of the Jewish sect that you might have a problem with. And it just made me think of that because, you know, we don't have a code like that amongst ourselves, or at least we've been brutalized to the point where it's non-existent. At least in the past, when there was segregation, things of that nature, we understood who the enemy was a lot more clearly than we do today. And I just wanted to put that out there. They have a code, and we should develop our own code as to how we deal with each other. And I think that if we stop anti-blackness, it'll be a major dent in the system of white supremacy. Thank you.
Any other commentary before we get to the second audio?
Can I just ask a question? Just throw this out there. What was his issue with the Bolsheviks? Because I know he called them a threat. So just wanted to know what was your opinion, Gus, or anybody else about the Bolsheviks?
My understanding, I thought he was saying that this was distracting from the overall focus on the global white minority and leading people, this concept, I guess, was leading people to focus on some level of nationalism with their little small group was supposed to have some sort of dominion or an out-and-out rejection of, I guess, quote-unquote capitalism, saying that, hey, we're going to be about praising what they call the proletariat and these notions of equality, and we're going to have more sharing, I guess, amongst white workers, and a rejection of what sound like, I guess, what people would generally call capitalist ideals. All of that, I just interpreted as something where whites are getting distracted from what they should be focused on in terms of the global maintenance of white supremacy and floating off, I think, sometimes where he was criticizing that as well as what was happening in Germany, any forms of nationalism or clan behavior that could lead to our isolated group of whites even being in conflict and violating the white code with how we're supposed to treat other white people and not paying attention to non-white threats, which is what he said led to the Russo-Japanese defeat for the whites in Russia. That was my interpretation of it, unless I'm in error. Other folks have thoughts?
I think that you're absolutely correct, because Bolshevism was basically a revolution that strictly confined itself to Russia, so it would be nationalistic, versus a global racist superorganism approach to white supremacy, which is what we're actually seeing is the case, is what the way it is. It's like you said earlier, the fact that they function on a global level as a racist superorganism, it cannot be overstated. And that's why I said earlier that I liked the map that they showed, where they showed on the areas that white people control. It's almost like the spread of cancer in the human body, because that's what I consider them, is basically cancer in human form. And that map kind of exemplifies how they spread like cancer, and we're living the reality of the spread of white supremacy, which is the cancer. Thank you.
Everyone satisfied? Anything else folks need to get in? I will
assume everyone is good. Didn't hear any commentary about the Stoddard debate with W.E.B. Du Bois this time around. So if people have commentary they want to share on that, if you want to add that during the second, after we finish the second audio commentary, we can include that then. But we are picking up, let's see if I remember my place. I think we're picking up on chapter 11. Should be picking up beginning of chapter 11. We'll have ample time, so if you had additional commentary that you did not get to share, make a note so you don't forget, and then we'll hear from you once the second audio segment concludes. Context of White Supremacy, Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Chapter 11, The Inner Dykes. We come now to the frontiers of the white world, to its true frontiers, marked not by boundary stones, but by flesh and blood. These frontiers are not continuous. Far from the European homeland, some run in remote quarters of the earth, sundered by vast stretches of ocean and connected only by the slate-gray thread of sea power, the master talisman which the white man still grasps firmly in his hand. But against these race frontiers, these inner dykes, the rising tide of color has for centuries been beating, and will beat yet more fiercely as congesting population, quickened self-consciousness, and heightened sense of power impel the colored world to expansion and dominion. Above the eastern horizon, the dark storm clouds lower, and the weakened, distracted white world must soon face a colored peril, threatening its integrity and perhaps its existence. This colored peril has three facets: the peril of arms, the peril of markets, and the peril of migration. All three contain ominous potentialities, both singly and in combination. Let us review them in turn to appraise their dynamic possibilities. First, the peril of arms. The military potencies of the colored races have been the subject of earnest and frequently alarmist speculation for the past 20 years, particularly since the Russo-Japanese War. The exciting effects of pan-Islamism upon the warlike peoples of Asia and Africa have been frequently discussed, while the yellow peril has long been a journalistic commonplace. How shall we appraise the colored peril of arms? On the whole, it would appear as though the colored military danger, in its isolated, purely aggressive aspect, had been exaggerated. Visions of a united Asia, rising suddenly in fanatic frenzy and hurling brown and yellow myriads upon the white West, seem to be the products of superheated imaginations. I say seem because there are unquestionably mysterious emotional depths in the Asiatic soul which may yet justify the prophets of cataclysmic war. As Hindman says, quote, "With all the facts before us, and with prejudice thrown aside, we are still unable to lay bare the causes of the gigantic Asian movements of the past. They were certainly not all economic in their origin, unless we stretch the boundaries of theory so far as to include the massacre of the whole populations and the destruction of their wealth within the limits of the invader's desire for material gain. And, whether these movements arose from material or emotional causes, they have been before, and they may occur again. Forecast here is impossible. A new Muhammad is quite as likely to make his appearance as a new Buddha, a reborn Confucius, or a modern Christ. Asia raided and scourged Europe for more than 1,000 years. Now, for 500 years, the counterattack of Europe upon Asia has been steadily going on, and it may be that the land of long memories will cherish some desire to avenge this period of wrong and repine in turn. The seed of hatred has already been but too well sown." End quote. Of course, on this particular point, forecast is indeed impossible. Nevertheless, the point should be noted, for Asiatic war fever may appear, if not in isolation, then in conjunction with other stimuli to warlike action, like population pressure or imperialistic ambition, which today exist and whose amplitude can be approximately gauged. We have already analyzed the military potencies of pan-Islamism and Japan, and China also should not be forgotten. Pacifist though China has long been, she has had her bellicose moments in the past and may have them in the future. Should this occur, China, as the world's greatest reservoir of intelligent manpower, would be immensely formidable. Pearson visualizes a China, quote, become an aggressive military power, sending out her armies in millions to cross the Himalayas and traverse the steppes, or occupying the islands and the northern parts of Australia, by pouring in immigrants protected by fleets. Luther's old name for the Turks, that they were the people of the wrath of God, may receive a new and terrible application. End quote. Granted that the Chinese will never become the fighting equals of the world's warrior races, their incredible numbers combined with their tenacious vitality might overcome opponents individually, their superiors. Says Professor Ross, quote, to the West, the toughness of the Chinese physique may have a sinister military significance. Nobody fears less than a stand-up fight against Chinese troops could whip an equal number of well-conditioned white troops. But few battles are fought by men fresh from tent and mess. In the course of a prolonged campaign involving irregular provisioning, bad drinking water, lying out, loss of sleep, exhausting marches, exposure, excitement, and anxiety, it may be that the white soldiers would be worn down worse than the yellow soldiers. In that case, the hardier men with less of the martial spirit might, in the closing grapple, beat the better fighters with the less endurance. End quote. The potentialities of the Chinese soldier would acquire vastly greater significance if China should be thoroughly subjugated by or solidly leagued to ambitious and militaristic Japan. The combined military energies of the Far East, welded into an aggressive unity, would be a weapon of tremendous striking power. The colored peril of arms may thus be summarized. The brown and yellow races possess great military potentialities. These, barring the action of certain ill-understood emotional stimuli, are likely to flame out in spontaneous fanaticism. But, on the other hand, they are very likely to be mobilized for political reasons like revolt against white dominion or for social reasons like overpopulation. The black race offers no real danger except as the tool of pan-Islamism. As for the red men of the Americas, they are of merely local significance. We are now ready to examine the economic facet of the colored peril, the industrial mercantile phase. In the second part of this volume, I showed the profound effect of the Industrial Revolution in furthering white world supremacy, and I pointed out the tremendous advantages accruing to the white world from exploitation of undeveloped colored lands and from exports of manufactured goods to colored markets. The prodigious wealth thereby amassed has been a prime cause of white prosperity, has buttressed the maintenance of white world hegemony, and has made possible much of the prodigious increase of white population. We little realize what the loss of these advantages would mean. As a matter of fact, it would mean, throughout the white world, diminished prosperity, lessened political and military strength, and such relative economic and social stagnation as would depress national vigor and check population. It is even possible to visualize a white world reverting to the condition of Europe in the 15th century. Thrown back upon itself, on the defensive, and with a static rather than a progressive civilization. Such conditions could of course occur only as the result of colored military and industrial triumphs of the most sweeping character. But the possibility exists, nevertheless, as I shall endeavor to show. Down to the close of the 19th century, white supremacy was as absolute in industry as it was in politics and war. Even the civilized brown and yellow peoples were negligible from the industrial point of view. Asia was economically on an agricultural basis. Such industries as she possessed were still in the house industry stage, and her products, while often exquisite in quality, were produced by such slow, antiquated methods that their quantity was limited and their market price relatively high. Despite very low wages, Asiatic products not only could not compete in the world market with European and American machine-made mass-produced articles, but were hard hit in their home markets as well. The way in which an ancient Asiatic handicraft like the Indian textiles was literally annihilated by the destructive competition of Lancashire cottons is only one of the many similar instances. With the beginning of the 20th century, however, Asia began to show signs of an economic activity as striking in its way as the activity which Asia was displaying in idealistic and political fields. Japan had already laid the foundations of her flourishing industrial life, based on the most up-to-date Western models, while in other Asiatic lands, notably in China and India, the whir of machinery and the smoke of tall factory chimneys proclaimed that the East was fathoming the industrial secrets of the West. What Asiatics are seeking in their industrial revival was well expressed a decade ago by a Hindu who wrote in a leading Indian periodical. Quote, "In one respect, the Orient is really menacing the West, and so earnest and so open-minded is Asia that no pretense or apology whatever is made about it. The Easterner has thrown down the industrial gauntlet, and from now on, Asia is destined to witness a progressively intense trade warfare, the Occidental scrambling to retain his hold on the markets of the East, and the Oriental endeavoring to beat him in a battle in which, heretofore, he has been an easy victor. In competing with the Occidental commercialists, the Oriental has awakened to a dynamic realization of the futility of pitting unimproved machinery and methods against modern methods and appliances. Casting aside his former sense of self-complacency, he is studying the sciences and arts that have given the West its material prosperity. He is putting the results of his investigations to practical use, as a rule, recasting the Occidental methods and tools to suit his particular needs, and in some instances, improving upon them." End quote. The accuracy of this Hindu statement of Asia's industrial awakening is endorsed by the statements of white observers. At the very moment when the above article was penned, an American economic writer, Clarence Poe, was making a study tour of the Orient, from which he brought back the following report. Quote, "The real cause of Asia's poverty lies in just two things, the failure of Asiatic governments to educate their people, and the failure of the people to increase their productive capacity by the use of machinery. Ignorance and lack of machinery are responsible for Asia's poverty. Knowledge and modern tools are responsible for America's prosperity." End quote. But, continues Mr. Poe, "we must watch out. Asia now realizes these things and is doing much to remedy the situation. Hence, quote, "we must face, in ever-increasing degree, the rivalry of awakening peoples who are strong with the strength that comes from struggle with poverty and hardship, and who have set themselves to master and apply all our secrets in the coming world struggle for industrial supremacy and for racial readjustment." End quote. And more recently, another American observer of Asiatic economic conditions reports, quote, "All Asia is being permeated with modern industry and present-day mechanical progress." End quote. Take, for example, the momentous possibilities involved in the industrial awakening of China. China is not merely the most populous of lands, containing as it does nearly one-fourth of all the human beings on Earth, but it is also dowered with immense natural resources, notably coal and iron, the prime requisites of modern industrial life. Hitherto, China has been on an agricultural basis, with virtually no exploitation of her mineral wealth and with no industry in the modern sense. But the day when any considerable fraction of China's laborious millions turn from the plow and handicrafts to the factory must see a portentous reaction in the most distant markets. 30 years ago, Professor Pearson forecast China's imminent industrial transformation. Quote, "Does anyone doubt," end quote, he asks, quote, "that the day is at hand when China will have cheap fuel from her coal mines, cheap transport by railways and steamers, and will have founded technical schools to develop her industries? Whenever that day comes, she may wrest the control of the world's markets, especially throughout Asia, from England and Germany. End quote. Much of what Professor Pearson prophesied has already come to pass, for China today has the beginnings of a promising industrial life. Even a decade ago, Professor Ross wrote of industrial conditions there, quote, "Assuredly, the cheapness of Chinese labor is something to make a factory owner's mouth water. The women reelers in the silk filatures of Shanghai get from 8 to 11 cents for 11 hours of work. But Shanghai is dear. And besides, everybody there complains that the laborers are knowing and spoiled. In the steel works at Hanyang, common labor gets $3 a month, just a tenth of what raw slavs commanded in the South Chicago iron works. Skilled mechanics get from $8 to $12. In a coal mine near Yichang, 1,000 miles up the Yangtze, the coolie receives 1 cent for carrying a 400-pound load of coal on his back down to the river a mile and a half away. He averages 10 loads a day, but must rest every other week. The miners get 7 cents a day and found, that is, a cent's worth of rice and meal. They work 11 hours a day, up to their knees in water, and all have swollen legs. After a week of it, they have to lie off a couple of days. No wonder the cost of this coal, semi-bituminous, at the pit's mouth is only 35 cents a ton. At Chengdu, servants get $1.50 a month and find themselves. Across Zhejiang, lusty coolies were glad to carry our chairs half a day for 4 cents each. In Xianfu, the common coolie gets 3 cents a day and feeds himself, or 80 cents a month. Through Shanxi, roving harvesters were earning from 4 to 12 cents a day, and farmhands got $5 or $6 a year and their keep. Speaking broadly, in any part of the empire, willing laborers of fair intelligence may be had in any number at from 8 to 15 cents a day. With an ocean of such labor power to draw on, China would appear to be on the eve of a manufacturing development that will act like a continental upheaval in changing the trade map of the world. The impression is deepened by the tale of industries that have already sprung up. End quote. Of course, there is another side to the story. Low wages alone do not ensure cheap production. As Professor Ross remarks, quote, "For all his native capacity, the coolie will need a long course of schooling, industrial training, and factory atmosphere before he inches up abreast of the German or American working man." End quote. In the technical and directing staffs, there is the same absence of modern industrial spirit, resulting in chronic mismanagement, while Chinese industry is further handicapped by traditional evils like squeeze, nepotism, lust for quick profits, and incapacity for sustained business team play. These failings are not peculiar to China. They hamper the industrial development of other Asiatic countries, notably India. Still, the way in which Japanese industry, with all its faults, is perfecting both its technique and its methods shows that these failings will be gradually overcome and indicates that within a generation, Asiatic industry will probably be sufficiently advanced to supply at least the Asiatic home markets with most of the staple manufacturers. Thus, it looks as though white manufacturers will tend to be progressively eliminated from Asiatic markets, even under conditions of absolutely free competition. But it is a very moot point whether competition will remain free, whether, on the contrary, white wares will not be increasingly penalized. The Asiatic takes a keen interest in his industrial development and consciously favors it, even where whites are in political control. The Swadeshi movement in India is a good example, while the Chinese and Egyptian boycotts of foreign as against native goods are further instances in point. The Japanese have supplemented these spontaneous popular movements by systematic governmental discrimination in favor of Japanese products and the elimination of white competition from Japan and its dependencies. This Japanese policy has been markedly successful, and should Japan's present hegemony over China be perpetuated, the white man may soon find himself economically as well as politically expelled from the whole Far East. A decade ago, Putnam Will wrote warningly, quote, if China is forced, owing to the short-sighted diplomacy of those for whom the question has really supreme importance, to make common cause with Japan as a pis aller, then it must be accepted as inevitable that in the course of time there will be created a mere clausum which will extend from the island of Sagalien down to Cochin China and Siam, including all the island groups and the shores of which they will be openly hostile to the white man. And since there will be no danger from the competition of white workmen, but rather from the white man's ships, the white man's merchants, his inventions, his produce, it will be these which will be subjected to humiliating conditions. It is not a very far cry from tariffs on goods to tariffs and restrictions on foreign shipping, on foreign merchants, on everything foreign, restrictions which, by imposing vast and unequal burdens on the activities of aliens, will soon totally destroy such activities. What can very easily happen is that the Federation of Eastern Asia and the Yellow Races will be finally arranged in such a manner as to exclude the white man and his commerce more completely than anyone yet dreams of. End quote. This latter misfortune may be averted by concerted white action, but it is difficult to see how the gradual elimination of white goods from Asiatic markets as the result of successful Asiatic competition can be averted. Certainly, the stubborn maintenance of white political domination over a rebellious Asia would be no remedy. That would merely intensify Swadeshi boycotts in the subject regions, while in the lands freed from white political control, it would further Japan's policy of excluding everything white. If Asiatics resolve to buy their own products instead of ours, we may as well reconcile ourselves to the loss. Here again, frank recognition of the inevitable will enable us to take a much stronger and more justifiable position on the larger world aspects of the problem. For Asia's industrial transformation is destined to cause momentous reactions in other parts of the globe. If Asiatic industry really does get on an efficient basis, its potentialities are so tremendous that it must presently not only monopolize the home markets, but also seek to invade white markets as well, thus presenting the white world with commercial and economic problems as unwelcome as they will be novel. Again, industrialization will in some respects aggravate Asiatic longings for migration and dominion. In my opening pages, I mention industrialization as a probable reliever of population pressure in Asiatic countries by affording new livelihoods to the congested masses. This is true, but looking a trifle farther, we can also see that industrialization would stimulate a further prodigious increase of population. Consider the growth of Europe's population during the 19th century under the stimulus of the Industrial Revolution, making possible the existence in our industrialized Europe of 3 times as many people as existed in the agricultural Europe of 100 years ago. Why should not a similar development occur in Asia? Today, Asia, though still upon a basis as agricultural as 18th century Europe, contains fully 900 million people. That even a partially industrialized Asia might support twice that number would, judging by the European precedent, be far from improbable. But this would mean vastly increased incentives to expansion, commercial, political, racial, beyond the bounds of Asia. It would mean intensified encroachments, not only upon areas of white settlement, but perhaps even more upon non-Asiatic, colored regions of white political control like Africa and tropical America. Here again we see why the white man, however conciliatory in Asia, must stand like flint in Africa and Latin America. To allow the whole tropic belt clear round the world to pass into Asiatic hands would practically spell white race suicide. Professor Pearson paints a truly terrible picture of the stagnation and hopelessness which would ensue. Quote, "Let us conceive," end quote, he writes, quote, "the leading European nations to be stationary, while the black and yellow belt, including China, Malaysia, India, Central Africa, and tropical Americas, is all teeming with life, developed by industrial enterprise, fairly well administered by native governments, and owning the better part of the carrying trade of the world. Can anyone suppose that, in such a condition of political society, the habitual temper of mind in Europe would not be profoundly changed? Depression, hopelessness, a disregard of invention and improvement would replace the sanguine confidence of races that at present are always panting for new worlds to conquer. Here and there, it may be, the more adventurous would profit by the traditions of old supremacy to get their services accepted in the new nations. But as a rule, there would be no outlet for energy, no future for statesmanship. The despondency of the English people, when their dream of conquest in France was dissipated, was attended with a complete decay of thought, with civil war, and with a standing still, or perhaps a decline of population, and, to a less degree, of wealth. It is conceivable that our later world may find itself deprived of all that is valued on earth, of the pageantry of subject provinces, and the reality of commerce. While it has neither a disinterred literature to amuse it, nor a vitalized religion to give it spiritual strength. End quote. To sum up, the economic phase of the colored peril, though not yet a major factor, must still be seriously reckoned with by a forward-looking statesmanship as something which will increasingly complicate the relations of the white and non-white worlds. In fact, even today it tends to intensify Asiatic desires for expansion, and thus exacerbates the third, or migratory, phase of the colored peril, which is already upon us. The question of Asiatic immigration is incomparably the greatest external problem which faces the white world. Supreme phase of the colored peril, it already presses, and is destined to press harder in the near future. It infinitely transcends the peril of arms or markets, since it threatens not merely our supremacy or prosperity, but our very race existence, the wellsprings of being, the sacred heritage of our children. That this is no overstatement is the issue. A bare recital of a few biological axioms will show. We have already seen that nothing is more unstable than the racial makeup of a people, while, conversely, nothing is more unchanging than the racial divisions of mankind. We have seen that true amalgamation is possible only between members of the same race stock, while, in crossings between stocks even as relatively near together as the main divisions of the white species, the race characters do not really fuse, but remain distinct in the mixed offspring, and tend constantly to resort themselves as peer types by Mendelian inheritance. Thus, a country inhabited by a mixed population is really inhabited by different races, one of which always tends to dominate and breed the other out, the outbred strains being lost to the world forever. Now, since the various human stocks differ widely in genetic worth, nothing should be more carefully studied than the relative values of the different strains in a population, and nothing should be more rigidly scrutinized than new strains seeking to add themselves to a population, because such new strains may hold simply incalculable potentialities for good or for evil. The potential reproductive powers of any stock are almost unlimited. Therefore, the introduction of even a small group of prolific and adaptable but racially undesirable aliens may result in their subsequent prodigious multiplication, thereby either replacing better native stocks or degrading these by the injection of inferior blood. The admission of aliens should indeed be regarded just as solemnly as the begetting of children, for the racial effect is essentially the same. There is no more damning indictment of our lopsided, materialistic civilization than the way in which, throughout the 19th century, immigration was almost universally regarded, not from the racial, but from the material point of view, the immigrant being viewed not as a creator of race values, but as a mere vocal tool for the production of material wealth. Immigration is, thus, from the racial standpoint, a form of procreation. And like the more immediate form of procreation, it may be either the greatest blessing or the greatest curse. Human history is largely the study of migrations, making now for good and for ill. Migration peopled Europe with superior white stocks, displacing ape-like aborigines, and settled North America with Nordics instead of nomad redskins. But migration also bastardized the Roman world with Levantine mongrels, drowned the West Indies under a black tide, and is filling our own land with the sweepings of the European East and South. Migration, like other natural movements, is of itself a blind force. It is man's divine privilege as well as duty, having been vouchsafed knowledge of the laws of life, to direct these blind forces, rejecting the bad and selecting the good, for the evolution of higher and nobler destinies. Colored immigration is merely the most extreme phase of a phenomenon which has already molded prodigiously the development of the white world. In fact, before discussing the specific problems of colored immigration, it would be well to survey the effects of the immigration of various white stocks. When we have grasped the momentous changes wrought by the introduction of even relatively near-related and hence relatively assimilable strains, we will be better able to realize the far more momentous consequences which the introduction of colored stocks into the white lands would entail. The racial effects of immigration are ably summarized by that lifelong student of immigration problems, Prescott F. Hall. These effects are, he truly remarks, quote, more far-reaching and potent than all others. The government, the state, society, industry, the political party, social and political ideals, all are concepts and conventions created by individual men. And when individuals change, these change with them. Recent discoveries in biology show that in the long run, heredity is far more important than environment or education, for though the latter can develop, it cannot create. They also show what can be done in a few years in altering the species and in producing new ones with qualities hitherto unknown or unknown in combination. End quote.
And that's where we will pick up at for next Friday. So I'm looking, if I had to take a gander, we might only have two sessions left. I am not sure. Presumably, Mel might have something to do with that, but we might be done in two. We'll have to see. We have at least two left, maybe one more, might only be two. We'll have to see how it goes. At any rate, we are done for this week. If you have commentary you would like to share on the second portion of the audio or anything else related to the text or the 1929 debate with W.E.B. Du Bois, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I will say it is not profound, but it is significant, and I think a credit to Dr. Welsing that we are reading this book right now with more overt conversation about white nationalism, quote-unquote, using that specific term, and even in the mainstream media, people saying, matter of fact, I heard on Seattle Public Radio today, they were talking about, they were saying that listeners were calling in and saying, why are you using the term white nationalist? Why don't you just use the term white supremacy? And that had to be responded to on the air. But it is profound. And again, a credit to Dr. Welsing that we're reading this book at this time, just based on her work and her suggestion. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free to dial in. Please don't wait till the last minute. All the people who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free if you have commentary. Folks have commentary? Anyone have commentary? Not sure. Not hearing any of the folks who have a hand up, if they had commentary or if nothing stood out in the second audio segment. Give 1 second, then I'll share some of the notes that I took.
Should I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I find it interesting. He seems to go in really heavy on Asians in this section of the text. And I think what we're seeing even right now, like I was saying earlier, is a rise of China as far as them becoming more or making decisions to put themselves in more strategic positions around the world. Up until it was like I saw a documentary on PBS that discussed like 20 years ago, this is before the United States really understood what the power of trade, rare earth minerals were, and as far as development of technology, China had bought up basically 99% of the rare earth mineral sites on U.S. soil, and they had discussed that there was only one company that was owned by a white American male on U.S. soil where the U.S. can get its own rare earth minerals. All the other ones were bought up by China. So China was thinking a long time ago, way ahead of the curve in regards to where they've positioned themselves now. And now that they're making heavy incursions in Africa, the same thing is going to happen. I'm sure they're going to try and get their hands on a lot of the rare earth minerals in that area as well, which will give them a lot of control and hegemony over the rare earth mineral trade, which without that, you'll have no ability to develop technology, computers, cell phones, nothing, anything of that nature. And then towards the end of the text, when they were discussing, he was discussing the immigration of non-white people and how that can shift the I guess he says the very soul of a people. I think it's because white people have gone around the world and done exactly the same by white men going to non-white parts of the world, not bringing their dirty white females from Europe, but actually taking non-white females from the areas that they invade and creating these mixed-race offspring that become the buffer class for white supremacy in the way that they're manipulated by the white males who father them by these non-white females. He's now, to me, he's going to say the reverse in this text at towards the end of the reading. He's saying the reverse about non-white people, but non-white people have never gone into any areas of the world with the idea of dominating, so-called racially dominating anywhere. It's always been the opposite. So it's just very interesting to see how he's dealing with this, because he's basically, again, projecting. He's making the non-white people, their behavior is being explained in a way that is indicative of white behavior rather than the reverse, which is the actual fact. The fact that this is what white people have done to non-white people, they're trying to make it seem like it, or he's trying to make it seem like it's the other way around. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Other folks that are with us have commentary they want to make sure they share. Other folks? Nobody else comments? At this moment, I'll share a little bit, and then if you have a commentary, anything you want to get in before we wrap up, you'll have time to do so. Just remind folks not to wait till the last minute if you think you have something that you want to contribute. So one of the first things that stood out during the second portion where he says, where he's talking about this alleged threat, he says, how shall we appraise the colored peril of arms? On the whole, it would appear as though the colored military danger in its isolated, purely aggressive aspect has been exaggerated. I think this is a theme we've discussed on the program for years in terms of whites lying, whatever word we want to use, if we want to use euphemisms, pretending, exaggerating, just out and out lying and saying that there's, you know, some conglomerate of, you know, dark folks somewhere on the planet or in another universe who are waiting to come and get us. And a lot of times this will be the justification for coming to commit really aggressive acts of violence and barbarism against the black people, some sort of justification that the Negroes were coming to get us. They had a plot, they were going to come get us or rape our women or whatever it is. I think the Slocum, Texas massacre, that was a part of that same racist mythology. It seems that Stoddard is from time to time, as though he is saying that, you know, we got to be careful. You know, these non-whites, they could, you know, come out and try and come after us. We got to be diligent, man. We got to be vigilant. You know, this is a big problem. And in fact, he does it within the same paragraph. So that's like the opening. That's like the first sentence that I read, right? Where he talks about this exaggeration of, you know, what type of threat any sort of colored military army would represent to whites at this time. So then he gets like two, three sentences removed from that, and he says that this seems to be an exaggeration, he says, And I say seen because there are unquestionably mysterious emotional depths in the Asiatic soul. Lawrence, like, even he still comes back to, well, these are Negros, so, you know, you never can tell, and it's always good to be suspicious to make sure that they don't get the best of us white folks. I thought that was really important as well. The next portion where he says, we are now ready to examine the economic facet of the colored peril, the industrial mercantile phase. In the second part of this volume, I show the profound effect of the Industrial Revolution in furthering white world supremacy, and I pointed out the tremendous advantages occurring to the white world from exploitation of undeveloped colored lands and from exports of manufactured goods to colored markets. His final sentence in this paragraph, he says that this domination of non-white people and all this prosperity that we have enjoyed, that this has been made possible, much of the prodigious increase of the white population. He talked about that, I think it was either last week or the week before, he talked about the huge growth in the population of individuals classified as white. I think that also is extremely important. When we say, when Dr. Welsing, when she emphasized that white supremacy racism is practiced for the purpose of white genetic survival on a planet dominated by majority non-white people, 9-to-1 ratio non-white to white, that is really important. That if I think the vast majority, if not all, individuals classified as white, I think their thinking is, if there is no white supremacy, we're not going to survive. Without all of this, and you might even look at both the election and everything else that, you know, has been talked about in this part of the world for the last year with the demographics shift and growing numbers of non-white or an increasing percentage of non-white population in the U.S. and the drug problem and the right or the lowering life expectancy for whites, a significant segment of whites in this area of the world, all of these metrics, any sense, whether it's based in fact and reality or not, any sense where whites think that white supremacy is in jeopardy or weakening it. They know, oh man, this is, you know, this could be it for us. Our everything is dependent on us keeping this system in operation eternally. I think that sentiment is carried out consistently. I see it in the book here. Next up, before I get some of our check, see, we had some other folks who called in. Where he says, to allow the whole tropic belt clear around the world to pass into Asiatic hands would practically spell white race suicide. Again, that same notion that if we are not dominating, and it's got to be, we have to be supreme over the entire planet, that if we lose our grip anywhere, our specter of domination, then, you know, that could be it for us. That's how serious this is and how vigilant and far-thinking we have to be about this. I think we talked about that last week where Roz submitted this book is written to make sure that whites do not commit these errors that he's talking about that could lead to white racial suicide. Where he says, let's see, the next one, where he talks about immigration again, you know, with everything that we've heard for years now about this issue, and particularly with the rhetoric that President-elect Trump used over the past year and a half, 18 months or so, it's right in line with what Stoddard is saying, where he's talking about immigration. And in fact, the metaphor that he used, he compares it to childbirth. I mean, that is serious. I mean, if you're thinking about it in those terms, it's almost that if you're allowing too many of these, you know, swarthy, dusky, non-white immigrants to come into your part of the world, it's akin to you having non-white children, which I guess is the way that whites think about it, because that's what you're hearing here. You invite all these non-white people and they have children, and as we've heard in this text, as we've always heard, whites struggling with fertility issues that they know that could be enough to tip the scale to where this thing kind of gets out of hand, and the flood waters, it can be hard to contain them once it kind of gets in. I'll stop there. The caller that dialed in from when I got a chuckle, our narrator going by the handle of Universal Alien, and Stoddard is griping in the book about undesired aliens. The person who dialed in from a block number, did you have a comment, questions you wanted to share?
Yes, I did, Gus. Thank you. Yes, I thought Universal Alien was really funny, too. But two things. I'm going back to when you took your break before, and we were talking about how white people have a code of conduct, and so they all stick together, and you were saying it's because they practice that code of conduct, they teach that code of conduct, and black people don't teach that. But I think some of it is that, even though I think they're somewhat insectoid, but and so they don't need to, they just swarm. That's just how they are. But I think a lot of it has to do with that they, white people know white people, black people know black people. White people know that if they're in a war and they don't shoot, that the people next to them will shoot them. They know that their military leaders will practice that aspect of military decimation, where we're going to kill 10% of you before the battle starts, and that way the other 90% of you will be compelled to go and fight. Or the Russians saying, you know, well, I tell you what, one of you gets to shoot and the other one gets to shoot you if you don't shoot. So I think that a lot of that coordinated behavior is because white people know white people, and they know they're going to get it. And they just know it. They don't even think about going against the grain. It reminded me of the white woman who, when Miss Bland, when we had heard that there was a black woman dead in the jail, the white woman who lived here with me said, no, I have to stay over here behind the building because I have to live here with everybody else. She's like, I have to live with these white people. They'll kill me. So I think that that's a really big reason why black people don't mind turning on black people, because they know black people. They know we're probably not going to do anything. We're not really into sadism and torture and, of people like us. We really find that loathsome and just abhorrent, and we wouldn't do it. So, you know, black people are more comfortable mistreating other black people than they are white people, because white people will kill you, and they'll kill their family members, and they'll kill everybody else if you don't tell them on. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. And the other part was, I can't remember right now. I didn't write it down. Okay, but that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Right on. I think all of that was in response to the portion in Stoddard's book where he said that white people, they respond instinctively. That was the term he used. They respond instinctively to some sort of non-white racial menace. And I just made my comments that Karma just reiterated and expanded on, just saying that I think it's more than just instinct with whites, that as Karma just stated, they know other white people. They have a lot of information about what they are supposed to do, the consequences if they fail to respond, and, you know, everything. And even how their failure to respond is a failure of their own white self-interest. They get all of that information in from a very, very young age. Anybody else have commentary they want to make sure they get in? I think we have Mel back with us as well. Do you have commentary also?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I might try to chime in twice, but I'm struck by the difference in these two statements, and maybe I'm not quite seeing them as. Maybe I'm seeing them a little bit too more closer than they are. In the last chapter on page 229, Stoddard said, the Asiatics, by their own efforts, built up admirable cultures rooted in remote antiquity and worthy of all respect. On 245 in this chapter, he says, at Chengdu, servants get $1.50 a month and find themselves across Szechuan. Lusty coolies were glad to carry our chairs half a day for 4 cents each. And I'm kind of struck by how Stoddard both emphasizes that the culture has some ancient significance to humanity, but also how cheap they are to use. And I did not miss the fact that he used lusty, and then he used lust in this chapter. And I don't know if lusty has a different meaning back then, but he keeps using that word over and over to describe these coolies, the coolies being, I guess, the slaves or very badly paid workers. On page 250, The quote by, I think, Ross Pearson, the professor he's quoting, it says, quote, depression, hopelessness, and a disregard of invention and improvement would replace the sanguine confidences of races that at present are always panting for new worlds to conquer. First off, his use of the word sanguine, which is, in my opinion, related to blood and vampires. So if they have a sanguine confidence, the white race, that they are always panting to conquer new worlds. And then the next quote, it is conceivable that our worlds may find itself deprived of all that is valued on earth, of the pageantry of subject provinces and the reality of commerce, while it is neither a disinterred literature to amuse it, nor a revitalized religion to give it spiritual strength. I am just not sad that white people would be sad if they didn't have the human factories of India or China. That statement to me just comes off as very just higher than everyone else and very ridiculous. On page 252, he says, quote, there is no more damning indictment of our lopsided materialistic civilization than the way in which throughout the 19th century, immigration was almost universally regarded not from the racial, but from the material point of view, the immigrant being viewed not as the creator of race values, but as a mere vocal tool for the production of material wealth, end quote. I think this is fascinating when you consider the violence done against Asian people, Asian American people throughout U.S. history. I'm not aware of Chinese slaves brought to the U.S., but I know many so-called Filipinos and Chinese were brought or came over to work the railroads. And I'm aware of at least one general ethnic cleansing of all non-white people about 50 miles from me here in the California mining town. To my knowledge, the ethnic cleansing, that one, like all the ones done to Black people, was economic. And it's interesting how Stoddard points out that these Chinese were brought here to work in the U.S., but they did not consider the racial ramifications of having a lot of Asian people here. I mean, I think the Japanese internment camps kind of show that. Like every now and again, the allowance of large populations of Asian people seemed to, again, occur to white people as a bad thing. And I'm reminded of, and I'm going to keep making this study session about him, but Richard Spencer, the I Only Care About Beauty and Excellence guy, alt-right, basically white supremacist, he was talking, I think this week, I think at the Public Policy Institute, about how Asian people are working in Silicon Valley and how they were pushing the whites out of Silicon Valley. Like they're overrepresented in California's Bay Area in the Silicon Valley workforce, and that's a problem for white people. And I'm just, it's like every now and again, it occurs to them that that's an issue for them. And I thought we would finish at New Year's, but I think I might have been wrong about that in guessing. That's all I have for now.
Wow, New Year's, like, that is wacky. I cannot imagine it taking us a month to get through 100 pages. That would be like 2 pages a week or something.
No, I'm not trying to finish in New Year's. Somehow I thought the book was longer than it was.
Oh, I did too initially. I did too. But yeah, we have been making great progress. We'll be done much sooner than I thought. At max 3, but I think we might be done in 2 weeks. We'll have to see how quickly it goes. I think Mr. Spencer, Richard Spencer, I think it's the National Policy Institute, and he's been everywhere. He's been, I can only conclude that whites must want a lot of people to know about his views. Might even be a good comparison to Mr. Stoddard presently, but he's been all over the place, tons and tons of interviews, probably more to come. Other folks, comments or things that stood out that they also wondered. Oh, the word lusty, I looked it up while you mentioned it because I did see where he used that term a few times. So lusty, definition, healthy and strong, full of vigor. And then the example they give it with the definition, the other farms had lusty young sons to work the land. So that's how they're using lusty the first day. And this is the first definition. It has no reference to sex directly in the first definition. So with the sentence that you read where he's talking about these coolies, where he says across Szechuan, lusty coolies were glad to carry our chairs half a day for 4 cents each, that these are some strong
non-white people who can do this work, although I think it's significant that this term, whites regularly use it to reference someone being sexually aroused. So that's that's important, I think, that connection between the two. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they share before we conclude this session? Last comment?
I have a question.
What's your question, Karma?
So have we concluded that it would be better if you had to bring in labor, to bring in the labor with women from their own ethnicity, or is it better to just bring in the laborers and not bring in women from their own ethnicity? Because I can't figure out which one they're saying is better.
Did Stoddard give an opinion on that in the text?
Well, he was saying about the ramifications, and I guess I thought he was talking about early New York when they let in all of those Chinese men to do work on early New York. And they all had white women. It was just, it was something that they had to do some ethnic cleansing about. But I can't tell. He keeps mentioning it. Am I the only person hearing that? I guess so. That he's so worried about the influx of immigrants. So I'm trying to figure out, is he saying you should let immigrants in to do the labor because they want the labor done with their women or without their women?
I definitely agree. I've been hearing a lot of his concern about immigration, and you know, this could be a big problem. I hadn't heard as much in terms of him talking about whether or not you allowed the females to come in or not, the sexual component that they could come in and terrorize white women, yes, but whether or not, and even him giving an opinion on which way would be better. I don't recall him being definitive about that. Do you all remember that component in the text?
Yeah, I don't remember him. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You go ahead, comment.
No, I think I was listening more to the other commenters talking about it. No, I guess it's my imagination. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think he was definitive in the text about that. But I think the interesting part about it, too, is where they're discussing white people having non-white people be the labor force, where the labor, they basically, it's not good to have this non-white labor force know more than you about the industries that you have them working for you in. And I just find that very interesting because that was the whole premise of the building of America, was basically kidnapping people to do the work that white people didn't want to do in the first place. And because they were the dominant group, they basically violently dominated the non-white people, the black people that, you know, that they enslaved and brutalized, to the point where they didn't get any uprising that was substantial to the point that they were overthrown. You understand what I'm saying? So to me, it was interesting that he brought up that fact, because to me, that's just essentially what they've done. But through violence and tyranny and genocide, essentially, they've been able to keep the non-white people in check to such a place that hasn't worked against them in any way. It's almost like how when you look at how the Japanese like had the locomotive, the U.S. locomotive that they broke down. Then they studied it, rebuilt it, learned how to function, and then they perfected making locomotives to the point that they now supply the vast majority of global locomotives. You see that there's a lot of non-white people that have been dominated that haven't taken that idea of creating, you know, learning from their industries that these white people bring, to bring that information to their people so that their people can collectively do what white people have done to others, which is basically build their technology to the point where they can try and, let's say, reverse the tide of white supremacy in any form or fashion. Non-white people haven't come to that collective understanding. And I think it really has to do with the fact that we haven't come to that point because we're not, we don't look at the world the same way, because there isn't a threat of genetic annihilation against us. We are the genetically dominant majority. So as a result, we don't have a viewpoint of the world that falls into line of that sort of
emergency, we have to dominate and kill everybody and everything so that we don't disappear. Like, it's just a total opposite in lifestyle from a genetic standpoint that manifests itself in the way that we function collectively versus the way that they function collectively. Thank you.
I think at least the impression that I'm left with is started particularly from the last sentence where he says the from the material point of view, the immigrant being viewed not as a creator of race values, but as a mere vocal tool for the production of material wealth. Wait a minute. Just make sure I didn't miss the whole, because it's a longer sentence. He's saying that that's an error, however we look at immigration, the racial component must be looked at. It can't just be looked at as this is going to be an economic tool. We can have them come in and do, you know, whatever cheap labor we want them to do or whatever other motivations we might have for bringing them in. At the end of the day, the racial component should dominate our thinking about this. So I think at least the impression I'm left with, if it's going to be bring them in and they can have their females with them, or if we're going to bring in a limited number and they're not going to have females, that we should already be thinking about this component racially and making sure that they're not terrorizing white women. If we're going to allow them in and females, then we still need to be mindful, because then they could procreate and end up, you know, drowning us if they get over here and have a lot of children, since they already come with their family intact or come with a sexual partner. So, again, I didn't see what he was definitive about which way, but it would seem that regardless, whites could do it either way, just as long as we, you know, keep in mind how this is operating to make sure it doesn't mess up the enterprise of white hegemony. I thought there was one other thing I was going to get in. I thought it related to something that Mel touched on, but it might have slipped my mind briefly. The comment about the, when he's talking about these lusty coolies, I think that could be another form of projection as well. I think it's consistent that non-white people, he's done it throughout the book, talking about the sexually virile non-white people. So for him to be describing these probably younger non-white people as being lusty and them carrying his bags and everything, to me that sounds very much, reminds me of the whole world as the white man's brothel. Richard Bernstein, he was a guest on that program way back in 2009, white man, married to a non-white female, no less. But it sounds very much like that I don't know, Mr. Stoddard even sounds like he could have been doing some of that, a white person just going out and having his fun sexually exploiting non-white people. But that is an interesting way of phrasing, talking about some non-white people who are doing work for you, where he's already acknowledging they're being exploited. They'll carry your bags or do whatever for a half day for, I think he said, like four cents or whatever it is. And he said there are lots of people like that. That sounds like exactly what's happening today, where you have these sexual exploitation environments where they have non-white people and they just keep them in impoverished conditions. And then you can go and do whatever you want, brutalize them, rape them, you know, for a biscuit or whatever comes to mind. We did our 3 hours. Hope we shared some constructive insight. Again, we should be done pretty soon, I think. Maybe 2 weeks, max 3. If you have commentary that you want to share before we get done or as we're wrapping it up, feel free to email in. I know we had one of our callers in the Bay Area. She said that this book helped her get a much better understanding of white supremacy just listening. She said she hasn't called in, but just listening, it has helped her crystallize some of the thoughts about Dr. Welsing. So glad to hear that. Anything that you want to share, just write it in. We can share it on the program over the next couple of weeks. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll review observations, news from the past 7 days. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, he'll be with us this coming Monday. We'll be discussing the television series Black Mirror. This was on the UK's Channel 4. It got picked up by Netflix this past season, the third season. There are not a whole lot of episodes. If you want to check it out before Monday, we'll check out one or two of the episodes to prepare for Monday. It is a very interesting series. It's sci-fi. It's often compared to The Twilight Zone, but sci-fi that is supposed to be both investigating technology and unforeseen problems with all this new and omnipresent technology. And in my view, racism, white supremacy is there too, equally investigating. Dr. Kevorkian, he'll be back with us Monday to break that down, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. With that, sobriety would be best. I say that consistently. This is still what they consider a holiday weekend, so keep that in mind. If you're going to be out and about, I don't know if you're traveling to see relatives, or if you're just going out to frolic and do whatever with the holiday weekend, stay codified. You know they're going to have checkpoints, sobriety checkpoints and what have you. If you're out in a vehicle, you don't want to be driving or even a passenger. If you're under the influence and end up having this be the time where you are stopped by Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no, whites are dangerous. It can be a very, very volatile situation in a matter of seconds. Take it seriously. I don't think being under the influence, alcohol, cigarettes, cannabis, whatever else, I don't think any of those substances are going to help us make phenomenal decisions if our life is on the line or we have to neutralize a race soldier. I could be in error. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.